take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting October 13th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, more radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio segments are being borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for October 13th, 1855. In Grenada, William Walker takes a private army into Grenada to overthrow the government on this date. Walker runs around a lot of South America taking over governments here and there while passing laws to bring back slavery into fashion. Not surprisingly, he is supported by volunteers and supplies from the Southern Confederacy states. Walker is even recognized as president of Nicaragua by the U.S. president. Eventually would be captured and killed by a firing squad. Well deserved. Also on October 13, 1902, Teddy Roosevelt threatens to work the coal mines with federal troops if the strike does not end. Roosevelt was a mouthpiece for powerful industrialists in this country. He was quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is a victim of conspiracy and injustice." Economic philosophy of Teddy Roosevelt. Also on October 13th in 1909, educator, rationalist, and founder of the public modern school system, Francesco Furer, is killed by Spanish Catholic monarchs. He was opposed to the influence of state religion and dogmas. He hated the Catholic Church monopolizing education in Spain, and they hated Führer. An anarchist militant and free thinker, he was blamed for the upheavals during the tragic week in July in Barcelona. After his execution, capitals throughout Europe, demonstrations are held protesting the execution of Führer. Violent confrontations between the protesters and the police occur in Paris, where over 500,000 people turned out. In Argentina, where 20,000 workers will have a general strike, which will last until October 17th. On a second anniversary 2 years later, protesters continue in the anniversary of Führer's death. A professor at Columbia University in New York is fired for daring to share a platform with Emma Goldman as more Führer modern schools are opened up around the world. 5 years later, in 1914, multiple bombs are planted at churches throughout New York, and anti-anarchist sentiments increase, which will lead to things like the Palmer Raids. Also born on this date in 1925, Lenny Bruce, stand-up comic, social rebel, hunted to death by cops throughout his career, imprisoned on obscenity charges, as the shows are banned throughout England and Australia as well. Nightclub owners, fearing police harassment, begin refusing to book him, and his career collapses. Lastly, it's been recently revealed that on this date in 1970, the CIA paid Chilean military $20,000 to assassinate the duly elected president of Chile, Allende. This Week in Radical History for October 14th, 1864, the first African-American daily newspaper, the New Orleans Tribune, begins publishing in both French and English. Also on October 14, 1912, Teddy Roosevelt, campaigning in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is shot at close range by anarchist William Schreck. Also on this date in 1985, Attorney General Ed Meese would be quoted as saying, "If a person is innocent of a crime, then he is not a suspect. So much for innocent until proven guilty." Also on October 14, 1994, commie folk singer Pete Seeger receives the 1994 National Medal of the Arts from President Clinton.
Fortunate to have back on our show a man who was on the first show of the season. He's a major influence on American music, and he's written such songs as "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?", "Turn, Turn, Turn," and with Lee Hayes of the Weavers, the song "If I Had a Hammer." And also such songs as "Michael Row the Boat Ashore," "On Top of Old Smoky," "Goodnight Irene," "Kisses Sweeter Than Wine," and "Weem Away" are just a few of the songs that he has introduced and kept alive through his singing. We're very proud to have this man on our show, not only because he's a great man, a fine man, and a great performer, but also because he performs rarely on television. In fact, he's only made one major television appearance in the last 17 years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to present on our show for the second time, Mr. Pete Seeger.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
What was not mentioned in the intro that you just heard is that the reason why Pete was not on the TV for 17 years was because he was blacklisted during a McCarthy hearing, witch hunts. And though the Supreme Court would rule in Seeger's favor years later, that he has the right not to discuss his political affiliations, he, like so many others, were still blacklisted for many, many years. When his mother's brothers bravely brought him back onto the airways, his song that he played on that show, The Big Muddy, was pulled from the show airways. The Smother Brothers protested, and he got him back on the show, and that was the intro you just heard. However, their show would also be taken off the air for insisting that Seeger be allowed back on the show to sing the song The Big Muddy. Here's that controversial song by Pete Seeger.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fools had to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I've forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. All at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where he'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool set to push on. Well, I'm not going to plant any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This week in Radical History for October 15th, 1892, the 1.8 million acres of the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana is opened by white settlers, forced proclamation issued by President Harrison. Also on this date in 1997 in El Salvador, President Romero is deposed by the military coup. In February of 1981, the U.S. admits having sent 18 CIA advisors to help the military junta. Then, as in today, here's a brief report on U.S. intervention in the up-and-coming El Salvador elections, this segment from Latin Radical Radio.
You tell us a little bit about what the Minister for Foreign Affairs from El Salvador said last week in the United States.
Hi, Warwick. Very interestingly, after the recent discussions that the United States Solidarity Groups had in El Salvador with the ambassador from the United States to El Salvador, where the United States admitted its previous interference in internal affairs of El Salvador. This time around, the United States would not be looking at direct interference or even indirect, if you like, interference that could be attributable to the United States in the coming Salvadoran elections. So when you then have the foreign minister of the nation, Marisol Argueta, going before the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., specifically asking for United States intervention. I guess that's put that ambassador in an interesting situation now with these comments by Minister Argueta, not just comments but appeal for United States intervention. I mean, she specifically put to the United States, to the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in Washington, that the proposition that losing in El Salvador would be not just devastating for the security and national interests of the oligarchy within El Salvador, but also for the United States. A big call that she's put out there, you know, from one fascist right-wing government to the supporting interests in neighbouring imperialist United States.
It's deja vu all over again. More illegal, more moral U.S. involvement in South America. For on this date in 1984, the Associated Press reports the existence of a CIA-prepared terrorism manual advising right-wing Nicaraguan rebels how to blackmail unwilling civilians into supporting their cause, how to arrange deaths of fellow rebels to create martyrs, and how to kidnap and kill, or as the manual puts it, neutralize government officials. This manual was first revealed by the Baltimore Sun in January, but the U.S. media, including the Washington Post and New York Times, buried it for years.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 16th, in 1859, white American abolitionist John Brown led an attack on Harper's Ferry, a U.S. arsenal in Virginia. With a group of about 20 men, five of whom were black, John Brown attacked and captured the arsenal with the intention of distributing the weapons and inspiring a slave revolt throughout the South. Although they managed to get into the arsenal, the raid was short-lived because Southern citizens and militia soon cornered Brown and his followers. When the U.S. Marines arrived, they stormed the arsenal, killing many of the rebels. The rest of them were captured and eventually hanged, including John Brown. John Brown was the first white abolitionist in America to engage in an insurrection against the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on October 16th, 1893, Emma Goldman is sentenced to Blackwell's Island Penitentiary for 1 year, her crime given a speech. In 1919, the Deportation Act to rid U.S. of anarchist aliens, thousands including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman jailed and sent packing to Russia. Quoting Emma, "And you, are you so forgetful of your past? Is there no echoes in your soul of your poet's songs, your dreamer's dreams, your rebel's calls?" Emma Goldman. Lastly, for October 16th in 1998, Abraham Lincoln Brigade is honored. More than 60 years after they took up arms against the fascists of Spain, of which Hemingway romanticized them and the FBI files blacklisted them, members of the anarchist all-volunteer Lincoln Brigade had finally been given an official monument in this country, as U.S. nor England at the time would raise a finger to help fight the fascists. This week in Radical History for October 17th, I only have one item. In 1920, John Reed, American radical journalist, dies in Moscow at age 32, chronicled the Mexican and Soviet revolutions, wrote the book 10 Days That Would Shock the World. Reed is the only American buried in Red Square. For a good movie about his life and his run-ins with the character in the movie Emma Goldman, see the 1981 movie Reds, starring Warren Beatty. That is the movie Reds.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 18th in 1968, black American track medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos were suspended from the U.S. Olympic team for publicly displaying the black power fist at the Mexico City Olympic Games 2 days earlier. As the American flag rose and the Star-Spangled Banner played, both Smith and Carlos had bowed their heads and raised their fists to represent black pride and unity. The gesture had been inspired by a recent movement encouraging black athletes to boycott the Olympics in protest of the oppression that black people still faced in America, despite the efforts of the civil rights movement. The display of resistance enraged many white Americans who stated that Olympic Games were supposed to be apolitical. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. On this day, October 19th in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell graduated from Geneva Medical College in New York, becoming the first woman in the United States to receive a medical degree. Elizabeth was originally born in England to a family that encouraged both their daughters and their sons to pursue a formal education. Upon moving to America, she joined the abolitionist cause as well as becoming an active women's rights advocate. After completing graduate studies in a London hospital, Elizabeth returned to the U.S., but finding herself barred from practicing in American hospitals, she established a medical clinic in New York for women and children. 10 years later, she founded a women's medical college there to train women physicians. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they all were put in boxes, little boxes all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university where they all got put in boxes and they all came out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You've been listening to more of Pete Seeger, and this has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI, whose audio I borrowed. Thanks to the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website for a whole lot of radical info I use in the show, and the Slingshot organizer for the inspiration for this piece. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said: if voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. The issue we explore this week is water. Water in Palestine, Israel, and how that relates to Massachusetts. We have two presentations recorded at a forum on water that took place October 2nd at Tufts University. The first presents an historical perspective of the Israeli-Palestinian water struggle by Elaine Hagopian, and the second is a description by Nancy Murray of a local campaign to challenge a compact by Israel and Massachusetts to collaborate on water issues. The introduction of the speakers is by Tufts professor Amal Bishara, who is also a Palestinian activist.
We are lucky to be in this fantastic town of activists, and I have to say that one of the reasons why we have this fantastic town of activists and academics who come together on nights like this is because we've had Elaine Hagopian in our community for so long. And so Elaine Hagopian is Professor Emerita of Sociology from Simmons College. She's an incredible institution builder for Arab Americans and has been for so many years. She was one of the founders of the Association of Arab American University Graduates. She's been active. One of the amazing things about you, Elaine, is that you work on local projects like Arabic Hour, which has been a 30-plus year community television show that has actually broadcast at various points very widely, but really has a strength in being about the community here as well. And then the Arab American stuff, and then also working on great issues of global size. Really one of the leaders of the right of return movement here in this country, and also an expert on water. So we're delighted to have you with us. Well, you are. And we're very lucky to have you with us this evening to speak.
Thank you.
And we are recording this event just audio.
I thought I had agreed with Amal that we'd have a one-sentence introduction, but I'm embarrassed, so forgive me, I'm catching my breath. Anyway, I'm happy to be here this evening, and they told me I have 15 minutes to speak. Now, it was 20 minutes, and so what I did tonight before I came is I talked to myself very fast, and it was 15 minutes. So I don't know if I can talk that fast again, so bear with me. My task this evening is to try to talk a little bit about the history of water proposals in the area. And I'm going to start by noting that in 1899, this was after the Basel meeting in which the World Zionist Organization decided to try to go for a state. But in 1899, they commissioned an Abraham Borchardt to go to Palestine to study the Jordan River Basin. I had maps up here that had the 1919 map, but I think they're all gone. I might have one extra. Well, no, it was yes, that one. Anyway, if you all have copies, it would be helpful for you. It's the 1919 map that the World Zionist Organization presented to the Paris Peace Conference. Chaim Weizmann, who was the president of the World Zionist Organization, presented it and basically spelled out what was to be the main theory, the main approach of the Zionist movement with regard to water up to the very present, and it's become more elaborated as we've gone along. So there was the 1899 study, and the 1919 map shows you the area that the Zionists wanted as a Jewish state, and it includes all of the main water resources in that area. If you look at it, it includes southern Lebanon, the Golan Heights, the east bank of the Jordan River, and part of the Sinai. And we'll talk more about that map later. In any case, Chaim Weizmann said at this meeting The whole economic future of Palestine, and mind you, it's 1919, so it was still called Palestine. The whole future of Palestine is dependent upon its water supply for irrigation and for electrical power, and basically to ensure a European style of life for the immigrants that they expected to come. And the water supply must mainly be derived from the slopes of Mount Hermon, the Golan Heights area, from the headwaters of the Jordan River, which are actually in the Golan Heights, and from the Jordan itself and from the Litani River in Lebanon. And you can see on the map that they go up 25 miles into Lebanon to come to the Litani River, which feeds into the Golan Heights area. And that's a basic theme of the Zionist approach with regard to water, that they must control it if they are to have a real state and attract people to come into it and for their development. In 19, there were a lot of proposals that came after that, but I'm going to go to two proposals before 1948 that mark out, in a sense, a debate between what the Israelis wanted and what initially the West in the form of Britain wanted, and later the Arabs. In 1939, the British commissioned a man by the name of Ioannidis, I-O-N-I-D-E-S. And this was after the Peel Commission had talked about partitioning Palestine. It was after the disturbances in 1930s. And so they sent him, and they assigned him to prepare a study of water resources in preparation for the possible partition of Palestine. And the main conclusion that Ioannidis came to was the following, and this is very important. This is one side of debate. Main conclusion was that irrigation waters of the Jordan River were to be used primarily within the Jordan Valley Basin. Look at where the Jordan River is on that map, and the basin is, of course, around that. And not to irrigate the Negev and other areas. In other words, not southern Palestine at that time or what is now southern Israel. So that was the conclusion of the 1939 plan, which didn't work out. In 1944, Walter Clay Loudermilk, an American Zionist, went to Palestine, and his plan called for the irrigation of the Jordan Valley, diversion of the Jordan and Yarmouk rivers, which are up near the Golan Heights, and to the Negev, divert it to the Negev in the south, and the usage of the Litani River in Lebanon for projects in what was to become Israel after 1948. So if you hear that position, which now talks not about the Jordan Basin, but diverting the waters into what became Israel and into the Negev, and basically to water the whole area. So that was plan, which the Israelis, or the Zionists at the time, 1944, agreed with. They even named had a statue of Loudermilk, named a building after him. And that plan and basically becomes the basis of what the Zionists do after that in terms of what they want. Now, I'm going to talk about post-1948. And I'm going to talk about it in two parts. So the first part will be on the Jordan Valley water development area. It will be around the river, the Golan Heights, in other words, the area that you see on the map. And part two will be on, after 48 and 67, will be on within Israel and the occupied territories. All right, so I'm going to talk about the Jordan Valley water development first. So think in terms of the river, the Golan Heights, and the diversion of that water. Before I get to that, I just want to let you know that there is a context after 48 for understanding some of the things that went on. One of these contacts, of course, was the Cold War. There was the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for influence in this area. So I'm going to give you the positions of the three main actors with regard to water and its politics in this context of the Cold War and in the context of the desire of the Zionists to have a Jewish state based on that 1919 map. So let's talk first about Israel after 1948. Israel wanted to control all water resources as per the 1919 map and the land on which they are found, of course. They wanted to thin out the Palestinian population within what was mandated Palestine and others as they went along in the areas. For example, in the Golan Heights, we have refugees that left that area. And they wanted to extend, here's the same thing, extend the water resources from Litani, the Golan, the Jordan River, beyond the Jordan Basin to the Negev and throughout Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories after 1967. That was their position. It's basically derived from the Loudermilk plan. The Arabs, after 48, their position was they wanted to get their fair share of water. Remember, they were just coming out of colonialism for the most part. They wanted to avoid normalizing relations with Israel, that is, integrating Israel into the area through shared water schemes and development projects. And they wanted to avoid schemes to resettle Palestinian refugees outside of their original homes and properties through proposed, we'll see later, proposed water jobs projects aimed at negating United Nations Resolution 194 calling for the right of return. So UNRWA was very much involved in this in the early days, that they were given a lot of money by the U.S. and even Great Britain to try to resettle the refugees outside of what became Israel. So the Arabs were concerned about water projects as leading to normalization with Israel, recognition of Israel, and resettlement of the refugees. The U.S. position was, in this area, to ensure Israeli statehood and everything needed to make it viable, including water. They wanted to use water resources in the area to create Arab-Israeli cooperation and Israel's regional integration and recognition. In other words, make them work together so then the Arabs will recognize them, so forth. A major part of that effort was to use water strategy to resettle the refugees in the Jordan Valley. There's a catch. At that time, of course, in 48, it was not under occupation. It was not until 67. And thereby, by settling them in the Jordan Valley, they would neutralize the right of return. Israel wanted the refugees resettled, but not in the Jordan Valley, because it coveted that Jordan Valley, which it saw itself getting at a later stage. Ben-Gurion used to talk about two stages of Zionism. You get what you can initially, and then you expand. And you know the Jordan Valley today is well controlled by Israel. It's in Area C, basically. Now, let me talk now, after I've laid out all these positions, about Part 1, the Jordan Valley Water Resources Plans. And here I want to bring to your attention that there are riparian protocols that are supposed to be observed. What is meant by that, of course, is that if you have water resources between countries, either on the borders or the water is flowing into each other's countries, they are supposed to, under international law, which has not been fully codified, but certain principles have been accepted, they're supposed to share those waters equitably. And the U.S. was very much involved in trying to get a riparian protocol going in the area. So, but in 1953, before the American plan, which I'll spend time on, Israel put forth a seven-year plan. And the seven-year plan centered around diversion of Jordan River water south to the Negev desert and establishing and working on establishing a unified and comprehensive water network that would be developed under a national water carrier project that would cover all parts of Israel and be ready for the 1967 extension into the occupied territories. What the Americans did, because there was a lot of unrest and there were a lot of shooting going on over water in the early 1950s, and the U.S. dispatched Ambassador Johnston to the area to work out a water plan. Now, one of the disturbances, the major one, the Israelis had entered in 1951 the demilitarized zone area between Israel and Syria. And they had moved up into that, which was against the terms of the demilitarized zone. They had moved up into the Hula Valley, which is at the foot of Golan Heights, which has a lot of water. And they wanted to drain swamps there and to begin that project as part of the network. The U.S. basically put a stop for a bit, but that project was completed in 1958 in the demilitarized zone. Now, so Johnson came in 1953 to 55. He had 2 years of negotiations. The Arabs were wary of recognizing Israel and agreeing to Israeli control over Arab waters or to bury the rights of the refugees. But the Arabs were finally convinced by Johnson, after 2 years of negotiations, that they were simply agreeing to riparian allocations of water, even though Israel got more than its fair share in this negotiations. So they thought that, okay, we don't have to do any projects with them. We just have to have technical relations to make sure that we have the proper allocations. So they agreed. And after this plan was put forward, Dulles, Secretary of State Dulles, made a very stupid announcement. And that stupid announcement basically was that, which renewed Arab apprehension. He said that in order to secure a lasting and stable peace in the Middle East, the United States would pay adequate compensation for the Arab refugees, meaning they wanted to resettle them and get rid of them. They would underwrite some of the expenses for a regional water development project, and they would guarantee new and permanent political boundaries which would replace the old armistice lines. This was in 1955. This alerted the Arabs that they were going to be taken in to try to recognize Israel and that the refugees were somehow to be resettled without a right of return. Dulles, by this statement, reinforced Arab refusal to recognize the state of Israel or embark on measures of cooperation with it. The interesting thing is the Israeli cabinet discussed the plan and they didn't take a vote because, again, they were afraid the refugees would be settled in the Jordan Valley, which they coveted in the future. And so they didn't take a vote on that plan. And the Arabs, the Arab Council, after the announcement of Dulles, refused to ratify the plan. And so, as a result of the failure of multilateral riparian allocation of water, it's now failed, they all went their separate ways. and it was unilateral action with regard to water in the Jordan Valley area. And Israel, because of its technologically advanced ability, was able to develop use of the water to a higher degree and to divert some of those waters for its own needs. More importantly, during this period of time, the Israeli National Water Carrier Project was restarted in 1955 and completed in 1964. The carrier took water to all parts of Israel from the Jordan Valley with potential for covering the future areas. At this time, the Litani was sort of dropped out of the Israeli vernacular, but not forgotten. But it was dropped. Now, if we go on to the second part of within Israel and the occupied territories, as opposed to the Jordan River, in 1948, the Zionists, as you know, conquered 78% of Palestine, and it drew Israel drew most of the of its water from the western aquifer. Those who have maps can see the western, and that's the most productive of the aquifers, which overlaps Israel and the West Bank. Most of the water comes out of the West Bank. The coastal aquifer, which is Gaza and Israel, and the Sea of Galilee, Tiberias, and gained the Jordan River Basin, as we already discussed, as well as Hula area in the DMZ. These all got tied in together through the national carrier. So they tied in all these resources through the national carrier project. And, you know, that company is called, I can never pronounce it, Mekarot. Mekarot, is that right? No. That's the company that Palestinians now have to buy their water from, because Israel controls all the water and they never get enough water. So they have to buy the rest from Israel, from that company, from their national carrier. After 1967, they captured the rest of Palestine and the water-rich Golan Heights. That is the most water is found, that congeals there, and the headwaters of the Jordan River are there, and they captured that area. And they also, the Sinai, which they, which they're out of because the U.S. Pulled them out. As you know, they had settlements in Sinai, and the U.S. pressured, and they finally got an agreement with Egypt, and the peace treaty with Egypt was more important. Now, Israel, in the occupied territories, pursued a policy through military orders. In other words, they create laws in order to take over the water. So they was under military administration at the time, and the orders were 92 in 1967, immediately after the war, and military order 291, 1968, which allowed Israel to monopolize access to water in the occupied territories and routinely deny Palestinians the right to drill wells or repair existing ones. So the water control in all of Palestine is now complete. There were other things that happened in between, but we get up to 1995, Oslo II, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I talked about it last time, but I'll just simply mention that the Interim Agreement on Water, which is Article 40 on water and sewerage, is masterfully vague. The Interim Agreement institutionalizes the existing system of water control and exploitation and then some. The wall has exacerbated the issue of water and access to water for irrigation, especially where the wall cuts you off. The settlements within the West Bank and the wall extend into Palestinian territory and eat up a lot of water. And so the situation for water for Palestinians is very, very dire, to say the least. We know that Oslo created a joint water committee with equal numbers of Palestinians and Israelis to govern water through Oslo. However, in order for Palestinians to build any infrastructure or do anything with water, they had to get a permit from Israel, and the joint committee, even though they were even numbered, if they didn't get the majority, didn't get the Israeli vote, that they had effectively a veto over projects. So none were really agreed to, or very few. So that it's very important if you have a chance to read Article 40 of 1995 of the interim agreement. There were other reasons why Israel went into Oslo, and basically, without getting into it, it was to fill out, was an easier way to fill out that 1919 map. And I think, you know, that map is very important. You can also get it on the internet, and it says 1919. I don't know why that didn't come out here. So let me finally just say two things. One, the Israeli policy that Chaim Weizmann indicated at the beginning in 1919 to the peace plan is still in force. And a recent, Ministry of Agriculture in 1989 spells it out even more. Said the representative said, it is difficult to conceive of any political solution consistent with Israel's survival that does not involve complete, continued Israeli control of the water and sewerage systems and the associated infrastructure, including the power supply and road network essential to their operation, maintenance, and accessibility. So this statement was made before Oslo. It still governed the way they looked at it. They talked about Palestinian rights to water but never spelled it out and postponed it to the final agreements, which they never got to. That's 20 years later now. So this continues to inform Israel's position on water. The final word is on the Lotani, which was part of the 1919 map. You know, in 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon, and while it had some of its flunkies occupying in the south, it remained there, and it occupied the area, southern area, until the year 2000.
Could you spell that river?
L-I-T-A-N-I.
Thank you.
Yeah, Lotani. And when they had to leave in the year 2000, it was was understood that they had been draining water from the Litani. Now, I don't know, and I can find out nowhere, whether they are still getting water somehow from the Litani because of pipes or whatever. I have no idea, so I want that to be clear. But as you know, when they left Lebanon, it was because of the Israeli mothers, soldiers who, in a sense, wanted them out, and also Hezbollah was very active. I would take any questions later. I'm sorry this is abbreviated, and it's longer than I thought. I'm sorry.
Thank you. It is my great pleasure to introduce Nancy Murray, who has been an activist for peace and justice in the Middle East since 1988, when she made her first visit to the West Bank and Gaza. And she has also been the education director for the ACLU of Massachusetts, so she's worked on human rights internationally and locally, and also been an incredible leader in our movement and a great inspiration for me. All right, but it's true. I have pictures of you in demonstrations in the 90s when I was a student.
Really?
Yeah. So I mean it.
I had long hair in those days. Well, great panel so far, and I'm going to bring it back to this country. I think what I have to say will fit right in with what you've heard, and you all get geared up to sign the sheet up here saying get involved in our work. I'm speaking now on behalf of an organization called the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, which emerged as a response to a Boston Globe article, which was published in November 2013. It was an article about the, quote, innovative water partnership that Massachusetts was forming with the State of Israel. I'm going to read you the headline to Aaron Aylworth's piece, and I say read it because it's quite long. This is the headline. Quote, in Israel, water where there was none. Necessity and ingenuity made Israelis leaders in water technology. Now, seeing vast global potential, they are teaming up with Massachusetts innovators. That's the headline. She went on to describe in glowing terms the water miracles wrought by Israel that, quote, her words, forced the desert to recede, end quote. And having just returned from a trip to Israel in the West Bank, I was well aware of the heavy price that Palestinians under occupation and Palestinian citizens of Israel were paying for what Aylworth termed, quote, this modern version of the land of milk and honey, end quote. I mean, all the stereotypes were in this article. On our trip, wherever we went in the West Bank, we encountered the stark inequality you have heard of just now. We saw Israelis who are now more than 500,000 in the West Bank. There are probably now close to 700,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They use more than 80% of the water from the West Bank's three principal aquifers, leaving less than 20% for Palestinians. Recent studies estimate that Israeli water consumption is 5 or 6 times higher than Palestinian water use on a per capita basis. And that was really visible because you would see what Amal has shown, you know, people trying to collect water whatever way they can to store it on their roof in the West Bank. Well, you know, Israeli settlements have swimming pools. You've all seen this, you know, green lawns, etc. So combined with house demolitions, the fragmentation of Palestinian territory by walls, military checkpoints, closed military zones, and settler-only roads that are off-limits to Palestinians, water has become a lethal weapon in Israel's decades-long battle to dispossess Palestinians of their land and livelihoods. Now, water has also been used as a weapon against Israeli citizens, especially Bedouin citizens of Israel. It's been used as a weapon against Palestinians further north, but we saw on our trip what was happening to Bedouins. When we traveled to the village of El Arakib in the Negev, which was one of 35 unrecognized villages in the desert that get no services of water from their government. Remember, these are Israeli citizens. El Arakib, where Bedouin have lived since early last century, has been repeatedly raided since 2010. Its houses have been demolished over 80 times. When we were there, it was 50 times. Now it's 80. That was 2 years ago, 50. Its thousands of olive trees have been uprooted, its sheep sprayed with herbicides, and its water sources seized. The Jewish National Fund, which is a central actor in clearing the Negev, just as you saw, it was a central actor in clearing what was, you know, taken over in 67 and 48. It has removed, its plan is to remove forcibly between 30,000 and 70,000 Bedouin, to take them off their land and put them into these very grim, poorly serviced townships. In their place, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is planting swiftly growing eucalyptus trees, which we saw. They were about this big all along the desert landscape. While Israel chose not to pipe water to Bedouin communities, it is now ignoring sound ecological practice by irrigating notoriously water-greedy trees in the desert. So, of course, none of this appeared in Aaron Aylworth's article. Instead, she wrote with enthusiasm about the collaboration between Massachusetts and Israeli water industries, which grew out of a March 2011 meeting in Tel Aviv between then-Governor Deval Patrick and Buki Oren. Buki Oren was the former head of the national carrier, Mekorot, which you heard about earlier. Oren wanted to launch Israel's water technology onto the world stage, and he saw Massachusetts and Israel, he said, as, quote, natural partners. Patrick was so intrigued by the idea that the following year his administration encouraged about 50 Massachusetts policymakers, venture capitalists, academics, lawyers, businessmen, and a few elected officials to undertake a, quote, water innovation mission to Israel. And here's what he said, quote, collaboration is key to serving the common good of our citizens, and the Commonwealth is thrilled to expand our partnership with Israel, end quote. At this deal-making summit with Israel, he said, again, this is the governor, we want to do good while also doing well. So he thought, you know, this is going to bring milk and honey probably to Massachusetts profiteers, you know. So soon water became a key component of the Massachusetts-Israel Innovation Partnership. Now, this is a partnership which has lots of different aspects to it, in high tech and so on, but water soon became a very key component. This partnership, or MIIP, for Massachusetts-Israel Innovation Partnership, is based at the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, or MassCEC, which was created by the state legislature in 2008 to develop clean energy projects. Massachusetts agreed to provide $250,000, matched by an equal amount from the state of Israel, for the winners of a yearly innovation challenge featuring collaborations between Massachusetts and Israeli firms in joint water projects. Now, this partnership around water grew with subsequent government-sponsored trade missions and the joint water tech summits, which were held in 2013 and 2014. And by the last year of the Patrick administration, MassCEC and the Israeli Minister of Industry, Trade, and Labor's, the Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Labor's Office of the Chief Scientist, that's our collaborating partner in Israel, announced a global water innovation network to push their technologies onto the global stage. So that's where things were at when the Patrick administration left office. Now, while all of this was going on, some of us, including many in this room, were doing our own organizing. We had, of course, long been aware of the growing business connections of all sorts between Israel and Massachusetts, mainly in fields like IT, life sciences, and, of course, security, right? They're the leading security, national security experts. But collaborating with the Israeli water industry for commercial gains did not strike us as business as usual, since water is essential to life, to the ability of Palestinians to stay on and cultivate their land. There's something more here than just a business collaboration. Israel's discriminatory water practices have long violated international law and UN rulings, and in its water deals with Israel, the Patrick administration put profit in the driver's seat and left human rights in the dust. So we formed the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, and there were some handouts here to describe what it is. Although our immediate goal was the termination of the Israel-Massachusetts Water Partnership, we recognize that the fight for water justice is local as well as global, and will doubtless be intensified as water insecurity grows in decades to come. So we are now making connections with groups working on water issues from Chelsea to Detroit, and welcome organizations to join that agree with our core principles, which are: water is a human right, water should be equitably distributed, water should not be privatized, and water should not be used as a tool of political oppression, which is clearly what Israel is doing. So what have we accomplished since we began organizing in December of 2013? Our first task was to inform ourselves, and we have been fortunate to tap the expertise of this university, of Tufts professors and students who have carried out water research in the West Bank. Then we set out to inform the public by producing and distributing education materials, publishing articles, giving talks. Some of the materials were here. I'm sorry if the copies ran out. We were able to target Governor Patrick and key figures in his administration in a manner they could not easily ignore. We hand-delivered to them letters written to the governor personally by the children of Ida and other West Bank refugee camps, describing what it is like when the taps are dry for months at a time. Here is what 15-year-old Ahmed wrote to the governor. I don't know what kind of work you are doing with Israel over water, but I'll tell you that you are supporting the occupation and violating human rights. Do you know that Israel steals most of the water and leaves almost nothing for us? Do you know that we don't have enough water to take showers in the summer, to clean the house, to clean our clothes, and sometimes we don't have enough water to drink because Israel doesn't care about us? 16-year-old Hala from Beit Jibrin camp informed the governor that, quote, right now, water didn't come to our house in the camp for over 25 days. We advise you to rethink your work with Israel because you are supporting a state that is killing us in so many ways. When I see a settler in Gilo settlement near us enjoying the swimming pool, green areas and a shower every day, and the refugee camp, in the refugee camp, we don't get enough water to drink because the settlers are using our water, I get angry. I get angry when I hear that people from outside are coming to help them steal our water, making our lives even harder. So in addition to distributing these letters, the children's letters to the governor and other officials, we got their voices featured in an online publication and on Patrick's call-in radio program and organized our own call-in to the government's office using these letters. Now, our main target has been the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, where the water partnership is based. And before its head, Alicia Barton embarked on another water trade mission to Israel in June 2014. A group of us, including one of the Tufts water experts who I see in this room, thank you for coming, had a meeting with her and some of her colleagues. We laid out the case why, in the matter of water, it was ethically wrong for the Commonwealth to view itself as a natural partner for Israel, as Barton herself had once termed it, echoing former Mekorot head Buki Oren. We urged her to visit the West Bank to see how Israel was using water as a weapon against the Palestinian people. And we kept the pressure up by sending hundreds of postcards signed by members of the public to the Mass CEC and by holding a spirited demonstration outside of its offices on World Water Day last March. Among those who took the literature we were distributing to passersby were two Mass CEC staff members, those who had actually, fortunately, oversight over just our subject, the water partnership. They invited us to talk further, which we subsequently did, seemingly to sympathetic ears. I mean, they seemed to really want to hear about the situation. So what have been the fruits of the campaign so far? We cannot say with any certainty right now that the case we made to Mass CEC and the pressure we applied has caused it to put the innovative water partnership with Israel on the back burner. But, we are told, that is where it is today as the agency sets its course under a new administration. In the months ahead, we hope to get a clearer sense of what involvement, if any, the state government will continue to have with Israel's water industry. Whether or not the partnership survives in its current form, we have our public education work cut out for us as water becomes a growing profit center for both Massachusetts and Israeli businesses. The New England-Israel Business Council has close ties to the recently formed New England Water Innovation Network. And the move of Desalitec, a Tel Aviv startup with close ties to the Israeli water company, Mekorot, to Newton, Massachusetts, to increase its competitiveness in U.S. and global market may be a sign of things to come. It is now, you might have heard, getting substantial media coverage for teaming up with Harpoon Brewery to produce beer from the Charles River. Has anyone... Stay away from that beer. So there is much more to do to educate the public about Israel's water practices. And please sign up. There is a sign-up sheet over there. If you would like, oh, okay, it's not there anymore. If you would like to get involved with our work, and you should also see to, what you can do to help ensure that the Ida camp in Bethlehem, that its residents have control over their own water supply. You could learn about this what's called the Ida Water Garden, which is now going to be created through One for Three's website. It's work that's really being pioneered right here in Massachusetts, and we all can play a part. So that's One for Three.
And Andrew's going to talk about that.
Okay, great. So I want to give the last word to Ala from Ida Refugee Camp, who addressed a letter not to the governor, but to, quote, all Americans. We know that you support Israel, and you'll never support us, Ala writes, except a few of you who believe in our rights as humans. All what we ask you to do is to educate yourself a little bit about what Israel is doing to us in terms of killing, stealing our lands, demolishing our homes, and, of course, stealing our water. They do all of that and most with huge help and support from you. We don't care if you support them, but don't kill us because we have done nothing to harm you. As you people say, have a good day. And so, thank you.
That was Elaine Hagopian and Nancy Murray speaking at Tufts University on the Palestinian-Israeli water struggle. We're out of time, but This Week in Palestine will continue to cover the work of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice as it works with the new administration on Beacon Hill.
Purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated with the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist, no, not this week, but just me, Tony Gosling. Flee fleeing from a four-year-long civil war, herded into a refugee camp, then turned out to take the long walk to find a new life in Europe. The Refugee Crisis, Human Cargo. Tonight, we're joined by journalist and author Alex Perry, whose book, The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free, has just been published. He's been looking closely at the reasons why people are leaving their homes. And who are the mysterious marine commandos some refugees have been encountering while crossing the Mediterranean? Also, Katie Hope's here from Bristol Refugee Rights, also to explain what happens when the refugees reach our city. And the BBC transmitted its long-delayed Panorama documentary called The VIP Paedophile Scandal, What's the Truth? As if they know, on Tuesday evening this week, which purported to show most of the claims, particularly against former Home Secretary Leon Britton, were false. It also portrayed London's XRO news agency, where many of those stories have come from, as failing to check their facts. So, is that it? Was the VIP paedophile scandal just a bout of paranoia from some bad apples? Or did Panorama tiptoe around the hard evidence? Trial by television of witnesses? And what did the Metropolitan Police think of the documentary in which they also appeared? Well, I'm joined on the line to discuss that now with the former First Tuesday producer, Tim Tate. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Tim. Can you hear me? Tim, can you hear me?
I can indeed.
Tim, what did you make of the programme on Tuesday, the Panorama? Because, as I've been saying there, there are quite a lot of suspicions, really, that that this was a partial documentary. Was it the sort of documentary you would have made?
Probably not, no. I think the difficulty is that Panorama got sucked into some of the very same faults as the prime source of the allegations that they were complaining about, and that's this organisation, XRO News. And I think if Panorama essentially did much the same as XRO has done, which is to rely on witnesses or testimony from people who cannot support and their allegations and really have severe credibility issues.
So, I mean, I suppose what you're saying there is that, and it hadn't actually occurred to me, that Panorama were relying on the same unreliable witnesses that XRO had been.
Yes, I mean, that's roughly what I was trying to point out in my blog the other day. It's perfectly reasonable to question XRO's behaviour, which has been both bizarre and, in my view, very dangerous. But to base a fair amount of your demolition job on XRO on the evidence of a witness who Panorama themselves on air said worried about his reliability, and rightly, I think is equally dubious.
Let's just go back 20 years or so to when you did a documentary about this, because you actually did uncover that there were some very powerful paedophiles in the Republican Party in the United States. I mean, we're obviously not saying necessarily that that sort of thing's going on here in Britain, but what did you discover was happening in America?
What I discovered was allegations, and what I did with those allegations was to seek some form of corroborative evidence, which is, I think, the great problem here, that there has been very little effort expended to seek corroboration. And I found the corroboration I needed for that film in an entire roomful of documents, which were grand jury testimony and indeed testimony before a state Senate inquiry.
So what was actually going on in the United States in the Republican Party?
Well, the allegation was that children in Nebraska, as that in that case, had been prostituted across the state and indeed to the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., up to and including the doors of Capitol Hill. And there was a deal of testimony given largely in secret, as I say, at grand jury hearings or state Senate hearings, which corroborated each other.
Now, I noticed that here in the UK, when that panorama documentary was going on, the Metropolitan Police actually issued a press release, certainly a statement of some sort. As the documentary itself was going out, it was starting to appear on the websites of some of the broadsheet newspapers, actually saying that the result of that programme on Tuesday could be to intimidate witnesses. I mean, do you think that's a fair thing to do? Because it actually seems like what they were doing was, even though they had agreed to participate in the Panorama programme, they were criticising it too.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, and if I'm wrong, I apologise, that statement from the Met was issued prior to broadcast. And whether the Met, I'd be surprised if the Met saw the film before broadcast, because that would be a very unusual step for any broadcaster to take. The Met statement was odd. There was nothing in that film which, in my view, would deter a victim of child sexual abuse from coming forward and making a complaint. You know, whatever else its faults, that film did not do what its enemies, and that's primarily, again, Exero, alleged it would do, which was, and I quote, to smear victims of smear survivors of child sexual abuse. I mean, it just didn't do that, and it was, frankly, something of a damp squib in every other sense.
I mean, if you had had the budget of Panorama, which is a pretty astronomical amount, what would you have done differently? Because, I mean, when I was looking at it, I was thinking, well, they seem to be focusing on some of the bad witnesses. I mean, there are actually very good witnesses out there. Is it fair for Panorama to make a programme where it looks like they have focused on witnesses who are unreliable? Because there is some evidence, isn't there? And they were actually effectively saying, and this was the headline, I think, in the Daily Mail, on the front page of the Daily Mail today, that was exonerating Leon Britton of any kind of involvement in this.
Yeah, I think there's two or three separate questions. Working backwards, Panorama did certainly give the impression at the end that Leon Britton was a man whose reputation had been unfairly traduced by a succession of bogus or dodgy allegations. There is some truth, I think, in that, insofar as the allegations are dubious or at best unreliable because of the sources of those informations. That does not make them wrong. It does not make them necessarily false. It just means they are very suspect and you have to tread very carefully. However, there is other evidence which I've published both on my website and indeed through national newspapers, which shows, for example, that there is a formal statement from a customs officer to the Metropolitan Police's Operation Fernbridge in which he describes stopping Leon Britton at customs at Dover, searching his car and finding a child pornography videotape. Now, that is a formal statement. It's sitting in the files of Operation Fernbridge. Panorama knows about that. It's no great secret. I published it last year. If you're going to raise the issue of Leon Britton, I think it's only right that you do so in a responsible, even-handed, and indeed accurate way, and I don't think Panorama did that. All of that said, I don't think Panorama's the problem. I mean, I think in 10, 5, or even 4 years' time, that Panorama programme will not really trouble anyone as a particularly fine piece of journalism. The problem is what unfortunately, you have to recognize as the other side, and that's the increasingly hysterical shouting of those who proclaim that there is cast iron evidence of a VIP or political paedophile ring. And there could be. I'm not saying there isn't. What I'm saying is that the absolute certainty with which this has been proclaimed in very loud voices and all over both the mainstream and the social media is absolutely very, very dangerous, because there isn't the solid evidence to support it yet.
What about the complaints that have been to the IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, allegedly anyway, by up to five special branch officers, that they witnessed investigations being closed down, Tim?
As to the best of my knowledge, what the IPCC has said is that it is investigating a number, it's a fairly large number, of cases in which allegations have been made that police investigations were closed down, and that certainly in some of these cases those allegations have come from former police officers. And that, I think, is very, very serious. I think that's, if the IPCC's investigations show that that is true, and that those investigations were closed down, then I think that is a very serious scandal. But, and I keep having to come back to this, what we are dealing with at this stage is allegations. And it's perfectly fair and right, in my view as a journalist, to say, well, we report those allegations. What is not good journalism, and is in this overheated climate, is very dangerous, is to proclaim those allegations as fact.
Now, you're blog, which is at timtate.co.uk, you talk about the louse and the flea. Why do you draw some sort of analogy between this Brothers Grimm fairy tale and what was going on Panorama on Tuesday?
Well, for those who haven't read Grimm's fairy tale number 30, the tale of the louse and the flea, it's very briefly, it's the story of a louse and a flea who lived together very happily, and the louse had a catastrophic accident while brewing some beer. It threw the flea into a tailspin, and the ensuing drama consumed the entire household, household objects, a child, and a stream which overflowed and finally drowned everybody. What struck me both about the Panorama and about the allegations it was investigating, emanating, again, I have to stress this, primarily from Exero, is that what has happened is that Exero has published without any due diligence, any corroborative checks, very serious allegations, has sent the mainstream media and social media and the climate, if you like, into a tailspin, much as the louse's demise did with everything in its house. And Panorama sadly fell into the trap, it became the flea, of following the same pattern. What has happened is that this has become trench warfare, with people on either side of the argument shouting at each other and adopting a position which is binary. It's either all true or it's all false. And the reality is that there are going to be bits of this that are true, there are going to be bits of this that are false. And what is needed, and if this is my main interest, if you like, as a journalist, as a long and old in the tooth journalist, is that when you're dealing with allegations, incendiary allegations, you don't just shove them up on a website or sell them to a tabloid newspaper or an Australian television company, as Exero did, and say, well, we're just publishing what people told us. You actually have a duty to do some investigation of your own, to check out the background, to try and find some corroborative evidence. And if you don't, what you're doing is not free speech. It's actually undermining both free speech, and it is creating a climate in which good child protection and the protection of children from sexual abuse is going to be set back. It's going to be washed, that's going to be washed away in the backlash, which is growing and is becoming ever nastier, in my view.
But Tim, surely the only reason that this has been journalists, maybe with on very low budgets, have been dealing with this story is because the police simply haven't been doing their job. And when they have started doing their job, there's I noticed on the LBC website, one of their top clips from the last week was one of the former police officers rang into LBC saying that they'd been investigating a massive paedophile ring, including some very senior figures in the East End. And the night before, sorry,
I can barely hear you.
Me now is that some former police officer rang into LBC, the London station, earlier this week and said that an investigation into a paedophile ring in the East End, where there had been several very senior people involved in that, they were about to make mass arrests, and it was just simply the night before the superintendent announced, well, the on-highs have been onto us, we're going to have to end this investigation, there'll be no arrests in the morning. When that sort of culture is around in the police, isn't it inevitable that the media, whether right or wrong, good or bad, are going to start picking up these allegations?
It's certainly inevitable, and I think, to be honest, it's right. I mean, it's one of the things we should be doing, and you know, it's the great sorrow that, by and large, my colleagues have failed to do that for many years. You know, our job is, one of our jobs, is to be the watchdog that barks at power. But you can't simply say, well, someone's made an allegation, I'm going to stick it out there and present it as fact, which is exactly, precisely what XRO has done.
Now, isn't part of the reason for that, Tim, the fact that we don't really have the kind of massive budgets that people like you used to have back in the 1980s to
I hate to disagree with you, Tony, but I happen to have seen XRO's accounts. And XRO was started with a £5 million loan. It has spent approximately £2.5 million of that over the last couple of years. Now, frankly, even in the glory days on the Cook Report or on First Tuesday or thereafter, I never had that kind of money.
Okay, Tim Tate, your website, maybe you'd like to just give that a plug and tell us about some of the books you've published recently, because I know you're pretty knowledgeable about this and a pretty prolific author.
Should anyone want to look, it's timtate.co.uk.
And your latest book?
My latest book is a book called Yorkshire Ripper, The Secret Murders, which is, I think, precisely the sort of journalism and investigative journalism which I've been criticising others for not doing. It stems from a 3-year investigation by a former police officer. It deals very carefully with facts, and it looks and found corroborative evidence which showed that Peter Sutcliffe is the most likely suspect for 23 unsolved murders, in addition to those for which he was convicted.
Okay, investigative journalist, former producer for First Tuesday, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the refugee crisis, Hume and Cargo. Tonight we're joined in the studio by journalist and author Alex Perry, whose book The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free, has just been published. Hi, Alex, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what inspired you to get into this subject and why you wrote the book, Alex.
I was posted to Africa. I was Africa bureau chief for Time magazine, and I was there for the best part of a decade. But the reason I wrote the book was almost from the moment I got to Africa, it became clear that our perceptions of Africa were way off, basically. And I, you know, turning to tonight's topic, the migrant crisis, you see the same thing happening there. I mean, it's African migrants are generally described as economic migrants, therefore bad migrants. We'll take people running from a war, refugees from Syria or Afghanistan, but anyone coming to better themselves is kind of seen as, you know, having greed as a motive and therefore a bad migrant. I mean, there's so many sort of misconceptions in that, you know, it kind of illustrates why I wrote the book. I mean, first of all, the cost of coming here is $5,000 to $10,000 to take a passage with people smugglers across the Sahara and on a leaky boat across the Med. So these are not, you know, that's quite a lot of money. So the idea that these are sort of destitute Africans looking to come to somehow, I don't know, get into the welfare system or take sort of low paid menial jobs is very often wrong. $10,000 is generally means that the people waiting around in detention centres in Sicily and so on are kind of middle class guys with degrees, you know, and imagine the kind of the grit and the determination it takes to cross the Sahara and then the Mediterranean. These are self-starters. These are people with a plan. They're actually exactly the kind of migrants that you want to come to your country. They're going to start something. They're going to create something. You know, they will be a benefit. And if you look at a place like Northern Europe, where the population is aging and running out of young workers and young managers, these are, you know, any economist will tell you, these are the guys that you want.
Well, hang on a minute, because most of the countries in Europe, maybe Germany excepted, are in totally the opposite situation, Alex, aren't they? They've got lots of unemployed. I mean, look at, for example, Spain and Italy. They're completely the opposite, where they're actually struggling to house and employ most of the people in their own country.
Well, the migrants aren't stopping in Southern Europe. They're not going to the places where there aren't great economic prospects. They're looking, you know, they're smart. They read ahead, you know. The other, it's only just dawned on the UK, for instance, that almost none of them are coming here. They're almost all going to Germany because Germany has a very efficient processing system. You know, Germany's going to take, what, close to 1 million people this year.
Do you think there's been a deliberate attempt to confect the two between... There is quite obviously a lot of people been released from refugee camps in Turkey, and these people are coming in a completely different point of view, really. Most of them are trying to escape a massive civil war, which has devastated their country. Isn't there been, a deliberate attempt to conflate people who are coming deliberately to try and get work in Northern Europe to better themselves and their families with those who are fleeing death?
Well, no, I mean, I think you see a real division. I mean, certainly from the politicians, you know, the politicians will say, well, we, you know, the guys coming from fleeing war and devastation, those are the ones we'll accept. Actually, they legally have to accept those ones. They're not allowed to refuse them anyway.
Well, what about when they put a giant great wall up, which is actually physically stopping them getting into the country? That's refusing them, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think that's basically illegal, as far as I understand it.
So you'd be perfectly within your legal rights to get a giant great pair of bolt cutters and chop your way through.
Well, I think under the convention, you know, UN Convention of Human Rights, if someone arrives in your country destitute, having fled, a place where their life is in danger, I think I think I'm right in saying under international law that you're legally bound to accept them. You know, that they have a legal right to apply for asylum in your country.
Katie Hope from Bristol Refugee Rights, is that right?
Hi, yeah, hi. It's the UN Convention on Refugees, 1951 Convention. You have to prove that you individually have been persecuted, so it's not just a blanket statement for anyone fleeing a war. You've got to prove that you individually have been targeted because of your race, religion, membership of a particular social group.
But what if, say, the house next door to you has just blown up and you feel, well, maybe I'm going to be next, so I better get out of here?
Well, certainly in developing countries, there's a kind of understanding that there's a de facto refugee status. If a huge number of people cross a border because they're being blown up, then you take it on face value that those people cannot return. And the key issue about being a refugee is that you've been forced to cross an international border. Your government will no longer protect you, and therefore you're in need of international protection. So,
what are your thoughts about the same question I ask Alex about this attempt to conflate the two, the migrants, economic migrants? So there clearly are some, and refugees from people who are quite within their rights to claim asylum because they've had to flee the possibility of death.
I think it sort of comes down to sort of slightly lazy journalism, really. It's just not really bothering to look into the reasons why people flee. And there's lots of reasons for forced displacement that don't quite live up to that very high standard of the International Convention of to be a refugee. There's still people who are migrants who have protection needs, for example. I'm sure you must have come across those in Africa, you know, huge numbers of people who might not individually face persecution or, you know, have that as the basis for their reason to flee, but they still have really huge humanitarian needs. And lots of countries are a bit better. I mean, we do this in the UK, but lots of the European countries have a whole system of protection for those people, which is called humanitarian protection. It's not full refugee status, but it's recognising they're not economic migrants. They actually have some sort of, you know, protection needs.
Alex, let's go back to what you were saying about people coming, particularly to get work, get jobs, start a new life for economic reasons. What are the reasons in Africa that they do that? I mean, is it fair to say that they're just trying to get a bigger house, a bigger car, that sort of thing?
It tends to be a sort of medium-term plan. I mean, from the guys that I've spoken to who make the journey from Africa and from the guys that
I suppose
met,
I'm saying, why now? Why not 10 years ago? Why not 15 years ago?
Well, funny enough, I mean, kind of slightly paradoxically, it's because Africa's getting richer. And because they're getting richer, you can afford that passage. Like, before, there was just no possibility of even leaving the village. Now you've been able to first of all, stay at school till you're 18 or possibly even go for universities. So you're better educated, you've got ambitions, you've got ideas, you know about Bill Gates, you've heard about, you know, different industries.
Maybe you read it on social media.
Right. But it's become a possibility to you now that it wouldn't have done if you'd left school, you know, after 4 years or something like that.
I mean, is it as simple as saying, well, somebody's going to provide that service to get me there where I don't need a visa, I don't need to go through all the, you know, the usual things I would have to do to gain legal entry to a country?
Well, okay, think of the flip side. I mean, for me, right, I'm a foreign correspondent. I travel to all these countries legally and for about a tenth of the price. You know, so it's simply, you know, that's the only method available. Can't get a visa, can't get on a flight without a visa, therefore have to go through the illegal channels. You know, I mean, so you know, I guess what's impressive to me is that people will still pay all that money to come, you know. And as I say, it's paradoxically, it's a function of Africa getting richer. And the plan is generally not to stay here forever. It's almost always to improve your standing back home. So you work for maybe 5 or 10 years, most of the money seems to be directed towards building a house. And then you arrive back home triumphantly after having, you know, made your fortune in a far-off land, and you marry the best girl in the village. That's generally sort of the plan. And it tends to be the second son. The first son stays there, runs the family, he's the head of the family. It tends to be the second son that is, it's a kind of family council that goes, right, you go and see what happens.
Now, is it a question that over maybe the last 10 years or so, this has started to happen, more people have actually come back, built houses, got that status, and that has almost been like a big advert to go and try and
make your fortune
up in Northern Europe?
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. And then you know, it's also, you know, the idea is that if you come in and you get a European wage, well, that'll go a lot further. So it's a kind of accelerator. You know, if you work for 5 years and save a fair amount, you go back to Ghana or wherever, you know, that'll buy a lot.
It's almost like you come back a millionaire kind of thing.
Well, it'll probably be enough to, you know, as I say, build a house and maybe start a business, you know, maybe have a couple of cars, that kind of stuff. So it's, yeah, it's an accelerator. But no, I don't see that many people. I mean, refugees are very different. They're, you know, particularly, you know, the influx you see from Syria now seems to be, you know, millions of people who have given up the idea of ever going home. You know, they've been 4 years in camps and they're saying, you know, it's gone. We have to move on. Whereas,
funnily enough, actually things have been turning around there. I just wonder if you've got any comments about what's been happening over the last week or so, with you know, actually 2 weeks now, isn't it? The Russians have been bombing and sending cruise missiles in to apparently take out ISIS and other Al Qaeda, Al Nusra Front. It may even be that the end of the civil war in Syria is in sight now. The Russians have intervened. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I you know. My thoughts are probably the same as anybody else, but in terms of, you know, I don't have any sort of direct reporting on the ground there, and so few do now. I mean, so much of Syria is essentially an information black hole to so many of us. But it, yeah, from what I read, it does seem that the Russians are not going to let Assad fall, and that in some way, you know, that may build some stability around Damascus. But the reasons the Russians went in was because it seemed like Damascus might fall. So I don't think it's in any way stable in Syria right now.
Yeah, and it's not going to be time to go back. Back to you, Katie. I mean, actually, maybe I should just finish by pinning you down, Alex, on this business. Do you think there's been an attempt to conflate refugees with these migrants you're talking about?
No. What I see actually is almost exactly the opposite. Is that, you know, the you know what David Cameron would call the swarm is you know, is, well, okay. People come together. You know, if you're coming from somewhere like Libya, you know, it's a real mix of people from who originate in different places, different nationalities, different ages even, sometimes a lot of unaccompanied children. And they arrive conflated. But what you see is a very deliberate effort to say, OK, you are deserving because you're being persecuted, but you just want to get richer, so out. And I think that's, well, it's economically illiterate. You know, migration is fantastic for the economy, and any economist will tell you that. Look at all the richest countries in the world. They have high migration.
Well, the economists might tell you, but unemployed people here won't, will they?
Well, okay, the evidence that migrants displace unemployed people from work is just not there. It's just not there. Theresa May, actually, her own department put out, you know, figures last year saying that was the case. You know, her speech this week was kind of factually unfounded, you know. But if, you know, look at, if you want to be isolated, if you want no migration, you're saying we want to be North Korea, we want to be Eritrea, you know, static, stasis, and really quite poor.
Katie, I wonder what your reaction was to Theresa May's speech this week. I know the city, actually, I was quite surprised to see many big business organisations right across the country pretty much roundly condemning what she'd said. And she's setting out her stall to be the leader. We know, actually, Boris is going to almost certainly be the leader. It does seem like she's shot herself in the foot.
Yeah, I really hope she has. It was just the most horrific bit of speech I've ever heard. But what was really sad about it is that underpinning all those disgusting views is actually an immigration bill, which, with all this focus on what's happening with refugees in Europe, is sort of slipping a little bit unseen behind the, you know, behind the walls of Parliament. It's got its second reading next Tuesday, and certainly for those people fleeing war and persecution, like you were talking about, Alex, you know, it's going to be horrendous. We already treat asylum seekers very differently from any other needy person in the UK. They're already on half the levels of what people on income support would be on, and they've just cut the rates for families. So all of this rhetoric about supporting people only overseas that are in resettlement camps and taking the most vulnerable, well, actually, just look at what we're about to do within the UK.
Now, you've said that we're treating asylum seekers differently to other people in the UK who are claiming benefits. What about comparing how Britain treats asylum seekers to other parts of the EU?
Yeah, well, that's really important too. And, you know, if you looked at what the government was saying, I think you'd think that we were taking enormous numbers in the UK. In actual fact, asylum seekers made up only 8% of those who came to the UK. 8%, it's absolutely tiny.
You've also got to look at the inequality here as well. I mean, but basically you have the number of people born outside the UK living in the UK are more or less balanced by the people from the UK living overseas. You know, I think the amount in the UK is 4.7 million. I think the amount of Brits working overseas, like me, is about 4 million. You know, so it's kind of unfair to say it's fine for you to migrate and travel and work if you're from a rich country, but if you're from a poor country, you stay where you are. You know, there's, you know, basically, we, in this age of globalization, we seem to have globalized capital, but not labor.
What are your thoughts about this immigration bill that's coming along, Alex? Because it's certainly, from what Katie's saying, it's going to make things more difficult for asylum seekers, actually.
Well, I mean, I've, you know, the immigration debate in this country seems to be sort of heavily coloured by the idea that, you know, which essentially came out of the rise of UKIP, that there is a large... Well, it's an idea in the politicians' minds, I think, that there is a large population out there that will be motivated by some sort of prejudice.
But they are... They're actually, UKIP, although they only got one MP, actually got quite a sizeable slice of the vote in the general election.
They did, they did. But did you also notice during the election campaign how many embarrassments UKIP had when, you know, candidate after member turned out to be racist? You know, what a surprise that was. And what I'm seeing, actually... over the last couple of months, is a rapid growing sophistication in how this issue is perceived and being treated. And I think actually, you know, politicians like Theresa May, who think they're onto a vote winner here, have sort of fallen behind the curve. There's you know, people have a much more nuanced view of immigration than they did even 6 months ago.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to a clip from Theresa May's speech earlier this week and see what you both make of it.
At the moment, for example, workers coming to the UK on very low salaries can claim over £10,000 on top of their salary in benefits, which makes the UK a hugely attractive destination. This is not good for us or for the countries those people are leaving. That is why the Prime Minister is right to target the amount we pay in benefits for those coming to the UK to work, and put these arrangements on a sensible basis. So these are the main reasons why net migration is still too high. But the trouble is, other changes mean that without the right policies, it's going to get even harder to get the numbers down. Modern forms of communication, cheaper international travel, and the increase in relative prosperity for many people in the developing world mean that large numbers of people are more mobile than ever before. And this is compounded by several other factors. For years, despite its many other flaws and its criminal leadership, Libya was known as Europe's forward border. British immigration officials worked there with their European and Libyan counterparts to stop illegal immigration from Africa at its source. Now the criminal gangs that smuggle people into Europe have been able to work unimpeded. Free movement rules don't just mean European nationals have the right to reside in Britain. They now mean anybody who has married a European can come here almost without condition. And Schengen, the agreement that abolished borders between EU states apart from Britain and Ireland, means that once a migrant arrives in a country with weak border controls, like Greece, they can make their way across Europe and into Germany or up to the British border at Calais without checks. Many of those people will eventually get EU citizenship and the free movement rights that come with it. Even actions taken with the best of intentions have consequences. When the German government, motivated by compassion and decency, said they expected to receive 800,000 asylum seekers this year, it prompted hundreds of thousands of people to try to get to Germany. Some of these people were refugees, coming directly from Syria or the camps in Turkey, Jordan and Lebanon. But many, in fact up to half of them, were migrants from other parts of the world. So reducing and controlling immigration is getting harder. But that's no reason to give up. As our manifesto said, we must work to control immigration and put Britain first.
Well, not quite as long a round of applause as David Cameron got when he had a go at Jeremy Corbyn, but what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, yeah, some of the points there were quite just based on very little, really. Why do we need less immigration? But I suppose for me, I'm talking on behalf of Bristol Refugee Rights. My key point here is her demonising of asylum seekers who make their way to the UK. There's some bizarre thing that she came up with in her speech that if you've managed to get to the UK, you're somehow going to be a fit young man who is not deserving of protection. But if you're taken from the camps surrounding, you know, refugee conflicts, that you're much more deserving. The irony is that when it comes to the new immigration bill, what Theresa May wants to do is take away support from families and make them destitute in country, in cities like Bristol. So that's going to happen to the people that we have who come to our centre. So if your claim for asylum is rejected, which many are, they get the decision-making wrong in 30% of cases, so 30% are overturned at appeal. All those people at the moment are entitled to some form of support if they can't return to their country of origin. When this immigration bill's passed, they won't be entitled to anything. So suddenly the local authority will have large numbers of families with children who, under the Children Act, cannot be left destitute to support. So it's going to... it's going to increase tension, apart from anything else, apart from making people homeless and destitute.
I mean, isn't the obvious thing to do to, for these people, if they're destitute, just simply to start working for organised crime? And that's what normally happens in most parts of the developing world.
Well, certainly reports that charities have done into destitution meant that they are absolutely forced into some sort of organised crime, prostitution. You know, they are really the most vulnerable people, and they are exploited in the UK, you know, if they're left in that position. So, yes, you're absolutely right.
Just give us an idea of what Bristol Refugee Rights actually does, because, you mean, you know, maybe looking at a couple of cases without going into names, and the bulk of the, what you deal with during the year.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so we've been around for 9 years now. We are a welcome centre that's open 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And we really offer that support, both emotional support and practical support that will help people when they arrive in the country and when they're newly given refugee status as well. We find people, they turn up, we have people from all sorts of backgrounds. A lot of, we were talking about Africa earlier, a lot of people from Africa, from fleeing, you know, conflicts in various different countries, and they come with nothing. They're absolutely bewildered. They've probably had a horrendous journey. And Alex has written an interesting book about, you know, what happens during that journey of being smuggled across Europe. They arrive in the UK and they have to go through the asylum process, which is a really tough process. You know, as I said before, you're proving that you individually have been targeted. It's not enough just to have fled in a generalised way. And they sometimes wait for a long time for a decision. They often have their decisions turned down, at which point their support is under question. And they're living, as I said before, on really low amounts of money, having bought nothing here and having no support networks here. But the key thing that we do in our centre is to try and address that isolation, the need to learn English, which is actually really hard now. You know, the same government that's trying to reduce the number of asylum seekers and is talking about not wanting too many migrants is actually making it more difficult to learn English. So we provide English classes and British life classes, which just explain some of the customs here, with a creche. We do work to help people with their cases, so around, you know, getting that support that they need, finding a solicitor that's an effective solicitor and helping them with their case, and just simple things like really warm, welcoming atmosphere where they can get a hot meal, which is often the only hot meal they get in the week, a haircut, a massage. It's just a really lovely place to come along and be. It's very supportive to those people.
But what do you say to those, in particularly unemployed people, people who've lost their jobs, is applying for job after job after job, who point their finger at people who've come from other countries and saying, well, they're taking our jobs?
Why does it have to be either or? I guess, you know, I would feel just as supportive towards someone who is unemployed in this country as I would do towards the people that we work with. I don't see why do the poor people in this society have to be pitted against each other? You know, it's, there's plenty of wealth in this country to go around to support everyone who's in need. And I'm not saying, you know, that's the focus of my work.
Well,
I know my work is
about... Certainly when it comes to welfare, the government would disagree with you, wouldn't they? They'd say, actually, no, there isn't enough wealth to go around.
Yeah, they would. Yeah. Yeah, well...
OK, well, maybe...
That's another show, really, isn't it?
Alex, coming back to you, tell us a little bit about who's making the money out of these other ways, unofficial ways, where you're not applying for a visa to get from Africa and other countries to Europe.
That's the great irony of Theresa May's speech. You know, here is the Home Secretary, the person who's in charge of law and order, and she's proposing a policy that essentially helps provide an opportunity worth billions of dollars for organised crime. You know, the African organised crime is making billions out of this, smuggling people across the Sahara and across the Mediterranean,
once they arrive in Europe, I was down in Sicily earlier this year looking into the Italian mafia's involvement in detention centres. Basically, they rigged the contracts to manage detention centres. And they keep people there for as long as they can. You know, I was talking to a bunch of... There were some Ethiopian guys and Nigerian guys. They're supposed to be processed in 6 weeks. They've been there 2 years because the guys that run the centre are making 32 euros a head a day from 5,000 people in that centre. You know, that's hundreds of millions of dollars. And so, you know, you have this situation where the forces of law and order who are saying we can't let undesirables in are actually boosting undesirables at home. They're boosting organised crime.
Also joined by Kevin Boylan. Kevin, you've done a little report for us, haven't you? Thank you very much. On this very strange phenomenon of, and there's been a little peppered through some of the press reports to do with what's been going on in the Mediterranean as people are crossing. Reports of Marines, military, actually appearing halfway across on the crossing. So would you just like to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Basically, I was in Lesbos Island in August, late August, and while I was there, I interviewed a refugee named Mohammed, and he told me about some attackers involved in clandestine maritime interceptions of refugees, struck migrants, between Turkey and Greece, and these are known colloquially as German commandos. Although Mohammed made his crossing without incident, luckily, he did tell me that some of the Syrians in his dinghy had done so previously and were terrified that such an encounter would be repeated. Luckily, they arrived on the north side of the island rather than the south, where that would have happened. He told me about a Facebook page in Arabic where references to the commandos may be found. I don't have any Arabic, so but I have discovered that the Arabic characters used at the site form an expression in Syrian or Palestinian dialect that means the centre or station, as in coach station, of those displaced who are having a difficult life. These commandos are dubbed German because they apparently speak either German or English when they intercept the boats. Many are reputedly blue-eyed. They are disciplined, they dress in black, balaclavas, carry US weaponry, M16s. They only operate at night, with their usual practice being to disable a refugee boat, search it for its occupants, that means permanently disable a refugee boat, seizing all their possessions, passports, money, etc. The commandos then throw the mobiles that they find into the water to prevent the victims calling for help. Men are beaten up, and the commandos tow the boat back to the Turkish waters, where the refugees are left to their fate. If they're lucky, they get picked up the next day by the Turkish Coast Guard, but if not, well, you can imagine. The waters between Turkey and Lesbos are patrolled by regular vessels of the Turkish and Greek Coast Guards, in addition to those of Frontex, this being the European Frontier Police. All three of these forces have been implicated in what's known as pushbacks and other crimes against international law, although it's clear that there are other more shadowy actors operating as well, including these commandos. Early on this year, the Greek Coast Guard was investigated internally in Greece for collaborating with unidentified civilian elements in pushbacks and robbery. But this has been allegedly stopped by the Syriza government. There are also, in all likelihood, criminal pirate gangs familiar with the waters operating out of Turkey that may try to rob migrants. And these freelance or irregular elements add a certain amount of confusion to the to the story.
Okay, Kevin, well, thanks very much for that. And we'll post some links to some of the articles that you've used to source that report on the show page. That's at thisweek.org.uk. Well, I better ask you about that first, Alex. What do you think's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something I've heard about. What I do know is that those that are trying to police the boats coming over are completely overwhelmed. I mean, for every rescue there are three or four that are unrescued, some of which sink, you know. And if there is, I guess, if there's something that is, if you're going to try and judge the seriousness of these situations, I'd say, you know, more than 2,000 people drowning without any assistance or intent from anybody else at all would be, I mean, that's a humanitarian disaster in itself. But I guess I wouldn't be that surprised if there was a kind of local vigilante group trying to send back migrants. I mean, you know, you get the same thing on land in almost every European country. It wouldn't be all that surprising to find a group being enterprising and doing it at sea. I don't know about M16s and all the rest of that, but, you know, it's certainly, wherever there's a mass migration, it will produce resentment in a certain part of the receiving population.
Tell us a little bit about this guy you mentioned in your Newsweek article. The last, I think it was the last edition, wasn't it, of Newsweek Europe, this went in just about under the wire.
before the news wake.
Yeah. Yes. I bet it was a good party anyway when you closed down. But anyway, Emias Ghamani, if I've pronounced it right, seemed to be making quite a lot of money out of getting people across the Mediterranean.
Fortune. Yeah. I mean, he's making... If you one of those little rubber ducks, rubber dinghies, you know, you can get about 250 people. If they're all paying 2,000 euros a head, something like that, I mean, you know, do the math. That's about, what is that, 550,000 a boat, 80,000 boats, something like that. I mean, it's a lot. And this guy's sending 20, 30 boats a year, and he's been doing it for 8 years, 9 years now. So, yeah, there's a lot of money to be made here. I mean, the basic point, you know, going back to what I said earlier, you know, you ban any commodity or any service, you know, through human history, you provide a market for criminals. You know, if the demand doesn't go away, look what happened to alcohol during Prohibition. This is the same dynamics at work here. There is a massive demand for travel to a richer part of the world. Now that we've banned it, we create this huge opportunity for criminals.
To wind up, because we're nearly at the 7 o'clock, coming up to the 7 o'clock news, Alex, sure. What would you like to see done from your experience? What would help sort some of this out? Because, I mean, we cannot have a situation where organised crime is using, making fantastic amounts of money here and actually promoting this commodity of human cargo, many of which are simply dying in the process.
I guess what I'd like is a kind of adult debate. You know, I don't want to see the kind of deceitful figures and sort of rhetoric that, you know, Theresa May came out with. You know, grow up. And, you know, this is a serious situation where thousands of people are dying every year, and grandstanding for your own political ambitions is, you know, I find it pretty offensive. You know, take cognizance of the, you know, of the families that are dying.
Basic problem here, isn't there, that it's a bit unclear as to whose law it is in the Mediterranean. It seems it's nobody's law or the law of organised crime.
Oh, no, I think that's fair enough. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, open seas, you know, who's in charge? But as Home Secretary in particular, you know, there's action that she can take here. You know, she's in the seat, and so to be using the situation to, you know, mess around with migration figures, the things that she was saying about net migration, she knows she's fiddling those figures. There are hundreds of, you know, over 100,000 students in those figures who are here on a temporary visa. You know, she's trying to blind us with, you know, like, grow up, let's get serious, and let's, you know, try and save some lives.
And also, Katie Hope, what are your thoughts about the solutions here?
Well, I guess it's people taking action. You know, there's been an outpouring of support for refugees and asylum seekers recently, which has been really heartening to groups like ours.
Right.
People there want to do something, and I would say there's lots of things you can do. One of them is to do things like sign a parliamentary petition that tells your own government that you want to resettle more refugees. There's one online at the moment that currently has just under 440,000 signatures. Go ahead and sign it. Okay. Support your local refugee groups.
OK, thanks very much, both of you. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Our sister show Dialect, Bristol's longest-running podcast, won't be here on BCFM next Tuesday. Sorry, but the show's been pulled by the management. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows, and freelance journalist Sam Downey.
Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. Last week, Russia brought the total number of countries which have bombed Syrian territory in 2015 to 13.
I think Russia is trying to forcefully put its stamp on the country so that it will be a major force to be reckoned with and will have a big say in determining what happens next.
This week, we'll have a conversation with Omar Dahi, Associate Professor of Economics at New Hampshire College, about the latest military intervention by Russia and the future of what remains of the Syrian nation-state. Later in the program, we'll speak with Iranian-American author and filmmaker Amir Soltani about his new documentary film, Dogtown Redemption. All this coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us. Last week, Russian jets started carrying out airstrikes in Syria. After a military buildup in Bashar al-Assad's western coastal heartlands, Moscow's intervention has brought a new dimension to an already catastrophic civil war driven by internal and external state and non-state actors. Shahram Aghamir spoke with Omar Dahi and asked him why Russia has decided to embark on direct military intervention in Syria. Omar Dahi is an associate professor of economics at Hampshire College. He also serves on the editorial committee of the Middle East Report and is co-editor of the Syria page for Jedaliyah e-magazine.
Well, I think it's important to put Russia's direct military intervention into Syria in the context of 4 years since the start of the Syrian uprising in 2011, 4 years of external military intervention by a variety of regional and international forces. So this current military intervention is the latest in the line of this long list of interventions. I think what is happening is that there are several dynamics at play. What we've seem to be witnessing is a brand new phase of the conflict. And this phase will be heading towards, in my opinion, some sort of settlement. And if you follow the news emanating from the region, not the one that's necessarily covered internationally, but at least in the region, there's been a lot of talk about movement towards some sort of political settlement. And I think Russia is trying to forcefully put its stamp on the country so that it will be a major force to be reckoned with and will have a big say in determining what happens next in the next phase, and will have a major seat at the table in that sense. So their end game, I think, it's too soon to tell exactly, but I think it's very ambitious. It's more ambitious than simply defense of the military base, and it's more ambitious than weakening ISIS, given what they've done in the past few days, the bombings and the targets of the bombings. They're trying to go after all the armed groups in Syria that are not government, and at this point, not ISIS either, to weaken them greatly or to dismantle them or to destroy them. Of course, this is what they ostensibly are going after, military bombing, whether it's Russia, the U.S., supposedly is targeting ISIS or not ISIS, but of course civilians die in the process. But I think their endgame is pretty ambitious, which is, along with Iran dictating the next phase of the conflict and bringing Syria under direct or increasing Russian control. Whether they'll be successful in doing that, I'm not sure, but I think that's what they have in mind.
2 weeks ago, Mr. Putin made it clear that his government's main goal was to protect the Syrian state, as he put it. A seemingly expression of concern for the unraveling of what is left of the Syrian state. What is your assessment of the current Syrian state?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the idea of preserving the Syrian state is something that initially framed the basic parameters of what was called the Geneva process. So if you go back to June 2012 and what is now known as the Geneva I Accords, those accords basically said very directly that there has to be a preservation of the Syrian state. They didn't say anything about Assad or the fate of Assad, and they left many other details of exactly how the political transition will take place to be determined later, and in many ways that set up the possibility of a civil conflict to ensue after that to sort of determine, you know, who would be shaping the contours of that settlement in detail. But the point is that the idea was to prevent a complete collapse of state institutions. And this is something that many countries, seemingly learning from the disastrous destruction of the Iraqi state, seemingly learning the lesson. In fact, what has happened is that since Geneva I, you've had a great deterioration of the Syrian state and state institutions. War, the violence, the destruction has brought the Syrian state to near collapse. And you also have to add on, of course, the economic sanctions that have been slapped against Syria in terms of weakening the capacity of the state to respond to societal demands, which are now increasing. And I'm talking about state institutions that have to do with the economic bureaucracy, the agricultural bureaucracy. I'm not talking about the army and the security apparatus that are bombing and engaging in the fighting and killing people. I'm talking about sort of basic institutions that are trying to pay salaries, that are trying to provide health care, education, and so on. And those have actually shown a very impressive resilience. I mean, they were predicted to be collapsing. They didn't collapse. People kept showing up for work. People kept delivering and doing the jobs that they were supposed to do, despite the fact that there was a war going on. And even in areas that are outside the government control, the government still pays the salaries of its workers, in fact.
How does that happen?
Well, they're basically coordinated in many ways with the armed groups in those territories. The armed groups allow this to happen for a variety of reasons, some of which has to do with that fact that many state employees are technocrats. They know how to run the flour mill, or they know how to run some of the infrastructure that's there, so they need them. They basically are provided in cash from a central location, and the workers come and pick it up. So there's a reality on the ground where, despite the fact that there's a war going on, the proliferation of militias and different groups meant also that they need to deal with each other. In some ways, they deal with each other in that type of exchange. Some of it is illicit exchange. Some of it is exchange of energy, because many of these armed groups control oil and natural gas resources. So there's a lot of that taking place on the ground as well. But the reality of the matter is that the state has suffered, and I think a lot of the discussion of the conflict really frames Assad as if the issue is Assad himself. And in many ways, this has become a way of distracting from the destruction of the Syrian state, of course, of Syrian society itself. And so constantly framing it as one side or the other winning really, in my opinion, ignores the fact that all sides have lost. All Syrian sides in the conflict have lost, because both the opposition and many people who don't identify with the government and who are against the government have suffered tremendously, and so has the government side. The government has lost tens of thousands of soldiers. The social base that supports the government has seen tens of thousands of young men killed, and you have a demographic in the social base of the regime of 18 to 35-year-old young men who have been killed. So they, too, have suffered and fear further annihilation. But in many ways, this gets left out of the coverage that frames it as Assad versus the rest, or Assad versus the opposition. You really miss the deterioration of Syria as a country and of state institutions themselves. I think Russia says that they're trying to prop them up. In many ways, they're trying to support what is remaining. The sooner the war winds down, the better. I'm not so sure, however, that this type of intervention will succeed, because the answer is not more bombing at this point. The answer is serious attempts for a political transition that brings together the majority of the people who are opposed to the government but willing to actually sit down and be part of a transition, even though they're opposed to this current regime, and also people from the government itself, and negotiate a transition that then begins to revive economic life, begins to address some of the issues, of course, that are going to be remaining problematic for a long time.
You did talk about state's role in providing services. Let's talk about the military, and you kind of touched on that. There are some analysts who cite the weakness of the Syrian military as one of the main reasons for Russia's military campaign in Syria. The strength of the regular Syrian army is estimated to have decreased from a pre-war figure of 300,000 to around 100,000. It's hard to estimate what it is now. This change has been ascribed to desertions and losses. Another factor has also been noted: the sectarian nature of the conflict seems to have created a situation where the Alawites, the Assad family's religious sect, are not willing to fight in the Sunni areas, but they're only willing to defend their own homes. What are your thoughts on this argument?
Well, certainly there's been a transformation of the relationship of the central government to its social base from an economic, political, military sense. And the government army itself has also transformed. Some of it are ways that we can notice. Some of it are ways that it's going to take a while to actually understand and absorb all the changes that are happening, because they're rapid and we get our information from many different sources, but we don't have the capacity to really study this in great detail. But I think it's safe to say several things based on what we know so far. And one is the fact that I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, that yes, there has been a great loss from the army. Some of it has been to defection. Some of it has been to people trying to leave and going to other places or fleeing to other countries. A lot of it, and most of it, has been from being killed by anti-government forces. And at the same time, we have to think about the transformation of the conflict itself. I think there's a big difference analytically and logically from 4 years ago, when the government was fully in control, was fully powerful, and able to, in many ways, dictate the pace and scope of events. And today, where the government is surrounded by hostile forces from the north, coming from the Turkish side, from the east in ISIS, and from the south in the southern front, in the sense that they fear annihilation. They feel if they drop their weapons, they might be annihilated, many of the people who fight for the government. So Assad, in a sense, his actual power has effectively diminished, because there's a proliferation of different militias and armed groups also fighting for the government. But his symbolic power is there, his symbolic power as a symbol uniting the government forces. In many ways, what you're saying is true. There are a lot of people who are defecting from the army today to go back, and they're not joining the opposition, but they're joining militias and other local defense forces in their neighborhoods. And to what extent this is happening, we don't know. We know it is happening, and it is signaling a sense of increased localism that you actually find happening all over Syria. It's really interesting if you go throughout the country now, also in opposition areas, a lot of the groups that are being set up in places that have been left by the government, there's a sense of attachment to that town and the local council and local governments in that town that are not really coordinating with any other towns or villages. They're independent units, in a sense. And part of this return to localism is because when the sort of fabric of society that was tying everyone together, when that is collapsing, people are seeking refuge and assistance in different, or perhaps what you can call more traditional networks, whether they're kinship, clan, other affiliations, identitarian affiliations, religious affiliations, tribal affiliations, in areas, of course, that have tribal formations, which are mainly in the east. So you see a lot of that happening, and we really don't know if this change is irreversible. We don't know the long-term impact, but there are definitely a lot of these trends. Now, going back to the issue of the government, you see a lot of the government forces, the regular forces, also being complemented by militias coming from Iraq and elsewhere. Of course, Hezbollah is fighting on the side of the government as well. So we don't also know exactly what is the outcome of these interactions. But we know that the government forces are diminishing. They're still present in several areas. They cannot last forever. And the latest intervention by Russia is further proof of that.
So since you mentioned fighters from other countries coming in, the Iranian regime and Hezbollah in Lebanon have both been staunch supporters of the Syrian regime throughout the political turmoil and the war in the country. Hezbollah forces are fighting, as you said, alongside the forces loyal to the Syrian regime, while Iran has, at the minimum, been financing and training fighters who are dispatched to help the Syrian regime. And these fighters seem to come from, as you said, Iraq and Afghanistan, too. In addition to that, the Iranian regime has been bankrolling the Syrian regime by giving it massive financial assistance. What effect or what impact has this role played by Hezbollah and the Iranian regime had on the balance of military or political forces in the country?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, as a general statement, it's quite clear and safe to say that the regional intervention from all parties has exacerbated the conflict and has not been a positive force overall. And that is because it removed agency, really, from the Syrian people. It hijacked a process that was an attempt by Syrian society to address its own problems. So I think that removal of agency and turning a social movement into a proxy war and into something that was fundamentally different is the biggest loss, that loss of popular sovereignty that was potentially there. And I think the legacy of that will haunt Syria for a long time. It's also the case that the Iranian regime threw in their support to indefensible, criminal, and illegitimate government in many ways that had spent decades in power, monopolizing power in various ways, eliminating dissent, and so on. I think, however, we also have to look at the situation leading up to 2011. I think one of the things I mentioned is that right before the Tunisian uprising, there was the WikiLeaks release, which talked about how a lot of the Gulf states had been agitating with the U.S. to further encircle Iran, to bomb Iran, perhaps, to further put pressure and diplomatic isolation to Iran. So from early on, Iran basically made up its mind that its own national security is tied to Syrian national security, that regime collapse in Syria will be a further step in circling and laying siege to Iran. And so they decided to support it at all costs. And again, given that the conflict itself transformed from a situation where the government, if it wanted to, and I think if there was pressure on it to reform and to move towards radical change, could have done it. But by 2012, 2013, it had become an all-out war. And when it became an all-out war, that's when you saw Hezbollah coming in with full force. And the role of Iran and Hezbollah transforming from providing diplomatic and financial support to providing military support. Of course, that has further exacerbated the sectarianization of the conflict. And I think it explains a little bit why Iran and the Syrian government would like Russia to come in. Because the more Iran is in there, the more the Sunni-Shiite divide that is really being pushed, the anti-Shiite, anti-Alawi type of agitation is being pushed by the regional Gulf states and dividing and polarizing Syrian society. So they want to pull back from that a little bit because of thinking about what might happen if they keep being involved and they keep increasing their military presence. But overall, I think it's been further radicalizing the conflict. In many ways, it has had a positive effect in that it has balanced. There's a certain pragmatism. Here I'm talking about some of the micro dynamics of the conflict, of course. But in many ways, Iran has also put pressure on the government in various locations to make truces, to make ceasefires, to allow opposition fighters to withdraw without being killed or attacked. Sometimes they have been allowed to leave with their weapons. So that intervention has also had an essence of potentially being useful should Iran choose to pursue that path. And one of the things that they've been saying is, or claiming, we don't know how much that's true, we haven't put that to the test, but they've been claiming that if the opposition drops its demands to destroy the state, to overthrow the regime, and you stop the military attacks, then there's a way in which Iran would be able to put pressure on the regime to effectively have a transition. But it's difficult to do that because there are so many sides on the conflict. So if Iran and the government were to say that they would be willing to accept a peace process, can the other side deliver? Can the other side, which has multiple militias fighting against the government, put an end to those attacks? I think that's what they've been saying as the reason why there is no one side to negotiate with. In some ways, that's obviously true.
And that's the voice of Omar Dahi, Associate Professor of Economics at New Hampshire College, speaking with Shahram Aghamir about the latest military intervention by Russia and the future of what remains of the Syrian nation-state. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us.
We'll discuss the role played by other regional players in this conflict during our conversation. But before we get there, Syria's armed opposition is thought to number more than 100,000 fighters. It is made of a number of groups. Can you help us understand who is who in this conflict, perhaps some of the major players?
Sure. Well, if you look at the map of Syria that over the last 2 or 3 years, we see periodically different organizations putting a map of who's controlling what part of Syria. And actually, if you were to look at a map from 2 years ago, you would see many more colors than you see today, in a sense that you'd see a lot of different militias, each controlling small spaces. This was in 2012, 2013, when you had a proliferation of many, many, many militias. What we've seen since then is a consolidation. And the consolidation has happened primarily in areas where ISIS grew, where ISIS was basically one of the many players in those areas outside government control. But when it was strong enough and what they felt themselves able to, they started consolidating and eliminating all of those other militias and taking over areas that used to be occupied by militias of different stripes. So a main part of that is ISIS, and we can talk more about it if you like. Another area that has seen some consolidation are areas in the northeast of the country that are under the rule of Kurdish militias or Kurdish political parties. And that area has, in addition to ISIS and government-controlled areas, shares with those two other regions a sort of holistic governance system where there's a more or less a monopolization on who is carrying weapons and sort of educational, economic, political, judicial sort of system that's integrated. And in many ways, this has led many people to believe that this is another step in achieving some sort of Kurdish autonomy, some sort of self-determination, and perhaps in the future some sort of de facto or de jure political independence. Now, aside from those three regions, that is government, ISIS, and Kurdish areas, we have a variety of groups, but basically under two or three main titles. One is Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated group. In many ways, their ideology does not differ than ISIS all that much. In some senses, they have been distinguished in that a majority of their leadership positions are Syrian, and that's not the case in ISIS. A majority of the leadership is Iraqi and from elsewhere. And majority of their fighters are Syrian. And they still have a belief, and this has been basically advocated by many supporters of the opposition, that they can be pragmatic. They can be brought along in the peace process. I don't agree with that. I think that despite the fact that many of them are Syrian, they hold a political project that was neither inclusive nor really one that can be thought of as a model, something that future Syria might be worth looking for. You have other groups. Some groups like are called Ahrar al-Sham, Jaysh al-Fatah, and Jaysh al-Islam. These are three different groups, some of which are more supported by Qatar and Turkey and others that are supported by Saudi Arabia. Those are considered neither Al-Qaeda, of course, nor ISIS, and they are what are referred to in many ways by the U.S. and by the other opposition as the moderate opposition. Moderate in the sense that they have a Syrian project, meaning they claim that they're fighting to overthrow the regime in Syria and install an alternative government in Syria, and as opposed to ISIS, that doesn't frame its project as something related to Syria at all. This is, they're creating Islamic State. And there are a lot of people in the opposition who seem to be supporting these groups. So it's not true that they have no presence in Syria, but it's very limited, I would say. This is not what was originally called the Free Syrian Army, which was mainly made up of defectors and people from local units, people from Syrian society who were opposed to the government. Both the methods of these groups, both their ideology, their outlook, their professed political goals are something that are highly exclusionary in many ways, and difficult to see how they could be really part of an inclusive model for Syria.
Isn't that part of the problem, that there is no cohesive and powerful opposition, in, be it inside or outside the country? Cohesive and united opposition.
Yes. Well, part of the reason for the lack of unity is the fact that a lot of the opposition has been driven, especially the external opposition and the armed groups, driven by alliances and de facto sort of proxies, becoming de facto proxies of different regional powers. So you had initially the what was called the Syrian National Council, which was based in Istanbul, which in many ways had very little independence from Turkey and Qatar. Increasingly, then Saudi Arabia started funding their own groups and split some of those oppositional groups, because Saudi Arabia was worried about the increasing influence of Turkey and Qatar, and so they wanted to balance within the opposition and within armed groups inside Syria, they wanted to balance those with groups that are loyal to them. So I think that's largely a reflection, not just, of course, as the opposition correctly says, of the regime banning and not allowing any independent political life inside Syria, but the fact that many of those opposition groups, I'm talking about politically, have accepted the patronage and accepted in many ways the foreign policy agendas of those different regional powers, rather than try to form a political platform that is inclusive, that they could be addressing Syrians, that they could be convincing and sharing with other Syrians. And that's been a great negative, a great deficiency in the opposition's project, because most of it has been really focused around convincing other powers and convincing the West to support them, to arm them, to topple the regime, rather than building a political platform that appeals to other Syrians, which I think has been a major lack. The government, as the de facto power, has a certain message. That message does not appeal to many Syrians, but it does appeal to many others. They have a stance. There's something that many Syrians know what it is, what's its pros and cons. And increasingly, many of those people who consider themselves loyalists, they're not loyalists because they love the government, but because they've looked at 4 years of the opposition trying to fight against the regime, trying to create an alternative, and they don't like that alternative that the opposition has created. And so they're not going to view the opposition as somebody that is desirable to rule over all of the country. And that's really reflective of the deep political divide that exists in Syria today. There are groups that, no matter what, will not accept Assad to rule over them and would rather perhaps even go to ISIS. Now, rhetorically, they say that. But the point is, there are other groups as well who find Assad yes, as the lesser evil. They've seen what the opposition has to offer and they don't like it. And that's what happens in a civil war. It's a deeply divided society.
Recently, there have been, as you mentioned earlier, ceasefire agreements between the Syrian regime and the opposition in some localities in the northern part of the country specifically. Now there is a concern that Russian air raids will bring an end to such agreements and escalate the tragic crisis of Syrian refugees. Can we expect a deepening of the crisis because of the Russian air raids?
Well, I think yes. Overall, if it continues to be simply bombing and more bombing, then yes, it's a deepening of the crisis because of the fact that everyone who's on the ground, who's able to see the conflict dynamics and the divisions, as I said, can see that the answer is only through a political settlement and not a military solution. There may be a role after a peace settlement has been signed, after maybe some sort of peace agreement. There may be a role for international peacekeepers. We don't know how that might happen, but in a sense, if there is a deep lack of trust in society, it may be useful to have a third party come in and be able to keep the peace and respond to the security demands. However, that has to be after you sign the political solution, the political settlement, because of the fact that unless people, unless different sectors of society and different sectors of Syria have a buy-in to this presence, it will always generate resistance. And we've already seen, of course, civilian casualties from the Russian bombing. We've already seen displacement, and that's a rule. If you look at what actions lead to displacement of people, if you were to go back to the post-war period since World War II, there are different things that cause displacement. There can be natural disasters and so on, but the one thing that always causes displacement, no matter what, is military intervention, is bombings. And that's what you can expect will happen in Syria. I think there's always this belief that if there's an overwhelming military attack, you might overwhelm those enemies and they're going to crumble and so on. But in fact, you're actually generating a cycle of violence that's going to continue. This happened in Iraq. It's going to happen in Syria again, regardless of who's the one who's doing the bombing. And so in the same way that I would say a U.S. more direct military intervention would make things worse, I would say the same for Russia. There's no different. There's no reason to believe that one type of military aerial bombing would be more or less humanitarian than the other.
So talking about preserving the Syrian state, and we talked about what the Russian agenda of preserving the Syrian state may be, do you think Russian intervention will be a game changer in the sense that it may succeed in undermining the opposition to the extent that any kind of political transition in Syria would lack any substance? In other words, it would essentially maintain the Ancien regime.
It's possible. I mean, there's definitely a very different phase now, that the conflict won't be the same because the fact that the regional countries supporting the opposition have to contend with Russia. Before, they were contending with Iran, which you could say, even though it's powerful, it remains a regional player. It's not a superpower at the global stage. And the only country that could presumably be a response to Russia is the U.S. And so the U.S. is not interested and in many ways is happy to let Russia take the lead and solve it if you can. In a sense. That seems to be the attitude of the U.S. leadership, that despite the fact that they're critiquing this, I think they'd be very pleased if Russia was able to impose some sort of settlement, given the statements over the past couple of years. I think that preserving the old regime might be difficult because of all the changes that we talked about in terms of what's happening in Syrian society. It may be the case that we have a different type of system, neither better nor worse. It has much more decentralization of power due to the proliferation of arms throughout society. It will have less of an ability of the central government to impose its will on different areas than it used to have before. And I think that it'll be a mistake if they think that they can impose stability in that way. They might claim that they're wanting to preserve Assad, but all the statements that they've made, at least outwardly, seem as well as Iran, seem to indicate that they're willing to oversee a political transition of some sort. Now, again, we know that a lot of this may be rhetoric, and whoever wins the war, if there's a decisive victory, will be able to dictate the terms, but I don't think there will be a decisive military victory, despite what Russia is trying to do.
Who has been targeted? The Russian government made it clear last week that it was going after a list of groups in addition to ISIS, and it's saying the targets are chosen in coordination with the armed forces of Syria. So who has been the target of Russian airstrikes?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that their main targets are not ISIS. They have been going to a variety of armed groups that include some of the groups that I mentioned, including Jaish al-Fatah and perhaps al-Nusra. And if you take a step back, I mean, what is the ideal scenario that the Syrian government and its allies will have at this point? Ideal meaning the best possible one, all things considered. The ideal one is to have two dominant groups, the government and ISIS. And that is because ISIS has been recognized as a problem by the whole world. And it's a problem for Syria as well as the whole world, meaning the Syrian government. On the other hand, these other groups are supported by many different groups and are not recognized as a problem. They're recognized as moderates and forces worth supporting. So they pose a problem for the Syrian government and its allies only. Eliminating them will set the stage for the Syrian regime and ISIS to be the only two choices, at which point the Syrian regime will become the de facto power and there will be an international coalition to eliminate ISIS. And in fact, the U.S. just today in the New York Times is sort of saying that they're going to step up attacks against ISIS. So I think it's rather clear, and in fact, the Syrian opposition is saying this. They're saying, look, they're not going after ISIS. They're going after us, the moderates. Now, this is the label they give to those other groups as moderates, but I think they're right in that the Russia's targeting has not been primarily directed at ISIS at all.
Let's go back to this question of regional players and international players in any sort of attempt to forge a transitional government or peace process. Turkey is a major stakeholder in this. How would Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and Qatar to a lesser extent, react to such a scenario in which the opposition will be essentially weakened or undermined to a certain extent that they will not be a major player in any sort of political transition? Turkey, of course, is going to play the refugee card with the Europeans. They have other cards to play as well. So how do you think this will play out?
It's hard to say exactly. We can look at their reaction right now, and it's been very critical of the Russian intervention. At the same time, Turkey has a variety of interests with Russia that go beyond Syria, that include oil and natural gas and other forms of regional cooperation and regional blocs. So when it comes to Turkey and Iran, Turkey and Russia, they have a variety of commercial and political and geopolitical interests that extend way beyond Syria in particular. So there's likely to be severe differences of opinion over Syria while there's cooperation on other avenues. Of course, Turkey is not happy to see its influence diminished. In many ways, Turkey has been the de facto power in the very north of Syria, has great support to a lot of the fighting groups that are now being targeted by Russia. So a lot of this targeting of armed groups will result, if they're eliminated, will result in the diminishing of Turkish influence. But I think by nature of geography, commercial weight, political weight, Turkey is always going to play a major role in Syria. In my opinion, there's not a major fear that Turkey has of being completely cut out. I think they will have a seat at the table when it comes to a regional settlement for those reasons. That's not the case for the other players, such as the Gulf countries. I think a lot of what they have tried to do is get a foothold in Syria through arming, through funding, and that is something that may cause them to be even more upset than Turkey about this. On the other hand, there's very little that they can do at this point because it's no longer Iran they're confronting, it's Russia as well. So I think it would be interesting to see what Saudi Arabia does to respond to this, given the fact that, of course, Saudi Arabia is carrying out its own pretty deadly and destructive attack in Yemen. And, you know, in many ways trying to say that, well, we're going to take over Yemen and regain our influence over Yemen and drive Iranian influence out. Of course, regardless of whether that influence was real or created, imaginary, but it might be some sort of way in which they give up or they diminish their foothold in Syria and gain that in Yemen.
In any sort of a political transition process that may happen in the future, do you think it would still include Mr. Assad?
I think it's highly plausible that he will be part of the transition. As I mentioned earlier, he has much more symbolic power than he does effective power. The government itself controls a small strip of Syrian land at this point. It relies heavily on its external backers. So what actual power Assad has is really questionable. And I think it's important for us to decenter the discussion from him. However, given the fact that a lot of countries have taken a forward position on Assad, and part of the reason that, for example, Turkey has really doubled down in its support for the opposition is because politically they would seem very embarrassed if they were to have taken such an forward position on Assad and then have to back down. I think they might accept a greatly diminished role, given the fact that there's a sense that the regime is going to stay in one form or the other. It might be the case that he plays a role in the transition so as not to appear as if, you know, that government was defeated, right? His departure now would indicate a surrender or a defeat for the government, and they don't think they're in a position to be defeated. That, you know, why should they surrender? But ultimately, it may be the case that there's a transitional period which changes the Syrian political system. Perhaps you have power-sharing agreements, perhaps you have a move towards a parliamentary system. And at the end of that period, you know, however long it may be, 1, 2, or 3 years, there may be national elections of which he may or may not be a part of. I can see that scenario as being acceptable to those powers, and to some extent also acceptable to many Syrians who are exhausted from the war, who just want things to end, whether they're refugees, whether they're internally displaced people, the people who are really bearing the brunt of this conflict. They want it to end. They just want some sort of resolution. And if they can see some hope of a new phase where they can regain their economic livelihoods, where they can, you know, not be harassed or persecuted if they were returned to Syria, to return to their homes, I think based on what I see, they would find it acceptable. There are many others who won't, but I think a large number of people will.
So, Omar, I just wanted to ask you this. This is not as related to what we have been discussing. There's this issue of Syria's electric grid mainly or ostensibly is running on natural gas. And a good source of this natural gas is located easterly of Homs. And that could be possibly a target for the ISIS fighters. The shutdown of the electric grid could be devastating to the regime itself. Is that something that the Russians might have been considering as a real menace to the...
Well, yes, of course. Of course. I mean, in fact, it's not only could be a target for ISIS, it has been a target for ISIS, and they have taken some natural gas fields. And if you look at the takeover of natural and oil gas fields that ISIS has had, they have deprived the regime of great sources of wealth and also relying on electricity and others. So they've certainly hurt the regime in pretty real ways, in addition, of course, to, you know, the killings of many regime soldiers. And adding on to that, the symbolic significance of the takeover of Palmyra, which is more than just an archaeological site for many Syrians. It's part of their collective identity, a collective pride. So they've really dealt major blows to the regime in that sense. And I think that's a big factor, especially because even in the best circumstances, so if you look at Damascus, electricity sort of consumption and service has been greatly deteriorated. You have electricity coming for 2 hours and then cut for 4 hours each day, just day after day. And if you look at the summer months, which are incredibly hot, you know, the possibility of fans and air conditioning is not there for many people, for, you know, even the middle class, the people who live in Damascus. And so the idea is that sense of normalcy that the regime has been trying to give, at least to large sectors of its population under its control, is being wiped away. They no longer are able to continue functioning as normal. And the more that time goes on, their ability will be less and less.
Is there anything else you would like to add to what we have just been discussing?
No, thank you for giving me a chance to talk to you and for your questions. I mean, one of the things that I'm constantly working with is the issue of the refugees and the internally displaced. This is something that is suffering on many fronts, not least of which is the funding. I hate to talk in this sense, but, you know, we need support, we need funding, we need people to reach out and try to help in some way for this great crisis. It's not just Syrian refugees, of course. We have Palestinian and Iraqi refugees. You know, the Middle East is now the largest older refugees in the world and others as well. So, you know, I would urge people, this is one thing that people can concretely do here about this crisis, is to support that aspect of it.
Can you give us some idea how people can go about supporting the refugees? Are there specific information that you want to provide to our listeners?
I would urge them to financially support. In terms of very reputable organizations, I would say Doctors Without Borders has been doing a great job. There are other local organizations, but Doctors Without Borders that, you know, just suffered attacks in both Syria and by Russia and by the U.S. and Afghanistan. They do a good job, not only because they provide different types of health services, but they also train the local population to provide services for itself, and they rely on capacity building in quite very meaningful ways. So I would find, personally, based on my experience and based on everything I've read about them, they deserve a lot of support, and they're internationally established, so you know they're trustworthy in that sense.
Omar Dahi is an associate professor of economics at Hampshire College. He also serves on the editorial committee of the Middle East Report and is co-editor of the Syria page for Jedaliah E! Magazine.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can always reach us via our website at vomena.org/blog or send us an email at info@vomena.org. You can friend us on our Facebook or find us on Twitter at twitter.com/vomena_radio.
Neighborhood where the poor, the unemployed, this is where they end up. This is West Oakland.
The new documentary film Dogtown Redemption delves into the lives of West Oakland's poor and homeless recyclers. Amir Sultani and Chihiro Wimbush follow the lives of three homeless people trying to eke out a living by recycling other people's trash. One of the questions the filmmakers raise is who owns our garbage, and what makes otherwise marginal characters important voices in the conflict over race, class, and public space in a modern American city.
Recycling not only has saved my life, my girlfriend is working on the street as a prostitute. She no longer has to do that because of recycling. As a person who works very, very hard for my money every day, I don't want to go to jail. I'm sick and tired of going to jail. And until I can get a job in Oakland, until I can get a job, I think that you should allow me to at least recycle. And all I'm doing is taking garbage. I'm not taking cars. I'm not taking cars. I'm not taking cars.
Concentrate poverty in certain areas. And that's the only place they allow it
to exist.
Poor people are seen as powerless people. Poor people are seen as people who don't participate. Poor people tend to be seen as people that you can dismiss.
I've been a recycler for about 15 years since I was a kid. And I piss everyone off because I pull more stuff to any recycling center than anyone can. It's pretty hard to stay healthy when it's cold and it's raining on you and you still gotta go out and get your route. And on top of that, if you have health problems, it's really hard to stay alive.
I had worked in Afghanistan before, and of course grown up in Iran. And so poverty wasn't something that I hadn't seen. But when I moved to West Oakland, there was a dimension of it that was just too painful to watch. And so I was staying at my brother's house on Magnolia Row. And every day, whenever the trash would go out, invariably you'd see someone digging through the garbage. And at nights, you'd hear the rattle of the shopping carts go by. And it was almost this spectral vision that, you know, we were in our houses and there was this movement outside. And these were Americans, really fellow Americans, if you will, who, in a sense, were like internally displaced people in America. They were like refugees. And they were surviving off our trash. And so initially it was just something that you noticed on the side of your vision kind of thing. But when you noticed that you'd put the trash out and several people would come to take the trash, you realized there was actually intense competition for it. And after the first person goes through your trash, you kind of want to warn the second person that, I'm sorry, there's nothing left. So I got more, you know, just by virtue of living there, the recyclers are part of the economy around your house. And that meant eventually I got to meet some of them and we became friends, or, you know, I just wanted to know who they were. Really, that was a very basic thing. It's like, who are you and what are you doing? And I think the strangest thing for me, Malihe, was that, you know, in Iran, obviously, there is poverty, but you never had this sense that the door of your house is closed on the poor. I grew up with my grandmother, and there was always this sense of feeding the people around you. In West Oakland, I had this sense that, you know, there's a lot of hunger around, there's a lot of poverty around, but there's zero communication.
I must have been alone all my life. Sometimes loneliness can overbear a person. I first met Willie when I came here to Oakland. He just was a person that was caring. And that was something, you know, I probably hadn't had in a long time. He'd always be with me. It's like my mentor. And I miss him right now.
I was born in Seoul, Korea, 1953. I'm almost 57. And it's hard to try and find something.
Oakland's history is very interesting and very rich and complex. So part of making this film was actually for me, who's experienced, I experienced myself as an outsider. This was the first time where I really felt deeply connected to a particular part of America. And so we actually did get to speak to various city officials, and whether in housing and health services or the police and so on. And of course, the mayor at the time, who was Mayor Dellums. And there was no question in my mind that there was actually, among many people in the city, there was a deep understanding of what was going on. But there wasn't a clear sense of a solution to it. And some of it has to do with disconnects within a city. So I was speaking to Mike Church, who worked in the city of Oakland at the time, and he was saying that people think that the city is this hyper-organized, fully structured organism, whereas in fact it's broken into many different parts, and the parts aren't always talking to each other. And I think when you follow the lives of people over time, you also get a sense of the places where they interact with the city.
This is the neighborhood where the poor, the unemployed, this is where they end up. This is West Oakland.
Look at all these people. All these people are working very hard to get there. Very hard. No one here can get a job.
How you doing? How's business? I am the redeemer. I redeem the money to the person who walks in. I can't weigh your glass twice, though.
That's all right.
Okay, so we'll throw this ticket away.
I guess it's not that good a pay, but it beats nothing.
Where else but America can you get up, be dead broke, no education, no skills, get yourself a shopping cart, walk around the streets, and make $100?
Everyone who recycles is just not a criminal or a crook. People have had some hardships in life. Some people were born into poverty. Some people were born with a half a chance to really make it out here. Lord, I got to trust in you. I want to come out of this. I want to live a quiet and peaceable life. Salute.
My whole family, they don't even want to talk to me. Just because, you know, I give everything away, you know, that's their excuse.
She says she had family in San Francisco.
This is it.
She says she actually tried to call them before, but no one would ever pick up.
I piss everyone off because I pull more stuff than anyone can. Drugs and drug abuse and getting high. It was like an escape, and it was a way to get aggression out.
I came back around 3 o'clock, and the place was surrounded with cops, and they were turning people away.
All this was the evidence they brought against us.
Leave us alone. Let us survive how we survive. This is how we survive.
Once you live on the street like me, it ain't gonna be my mom or my dad, the preacher, the church, or anyone who's gonna help me out, really. The street's gonna pay me. In one way or another, the street's gonna pay me.
Dogtown Redemption will be screened at this year's Mill Valley Film Festival on Saturday, October 10th and Thursday, October 15th. For more information, visit mvff.com. That's mvff.com. We'll put this information on our website at bomina.org. Please tune in next week to hear our extended conversation with Dogtown Redemption's co-director, Amir Sultani. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Our time is running out. The Arctic sea ice is going. With Cambridge glaciology professor Peter Wadhams. As I'm recording this introduction at the beginning of October 2015, Professor Peter Wadhams is on the research vessel Sikulyak. They're doing the annual assessment of the shrinking sea ice in the Arctic. Wadhams is professor of ocean physics at the University of Cambridge, UK. With over 40 years of research on Arctic sea ice, he's considered one of the leading experts in his field. Recently, Wadhams has gone public on an additional danger. It's related to the loss of sea ice. The Arctic summer ends in September, and observations show a tendency of shrinking ice. That's followed by a dramatic lack of regrowth of ice during the subsequent Arctic winter. Wadhams made studies from submarines that show that the new ice is thin and slushy and easily broken up by winds. An ice-free Arctic in September would accelerate the already occurring methane releases from the permafrost land areas and the shallow waters along the continental shelves. Methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Professor Peter Wadhams gave me permission to adapt for radio an interview he gave to Judy Soule in May of 2015. Judy Soule is founding the University of Earth in South Africa. Her interview with Professor Wadhams was released on YouTube under the title, "Our Time is Running Out, the Arctic Sea Ice is Going." Judy Soule asked Professor Wadhams to introduce himself.
My name's Peter Wadhams, and I'm the Professor of Ocean Physics in University of Cambridge, based at the Department of Applied Maths and Theoretical Physics, which is the same department that has Stephen Hawking in it. And I've been working for the last 40 years on sea ice research and polar oceanography and how the changes in the Arctic and Antarctic ice are affecting the world climate. I've run a research group where we work up in the Arctic on using various means, including submarines, aircraft, and walking around on the ice drilling holes. So I've got a lot of experience of the Arctic, really going back to 1970 when I first went through the Northwest Passage.
My first question to you is, are you concerned about what you're seeing? What are you noticing about the Arctic, and are you concerned about it?
Oh, well, it's amazing changes, yes. Just in what you see, apart from what you measure, because I've been measuring ice thickness going down by 50% over the last 30 years, but what you see in the summer, for instance, used to be very heavy pack ice remaining across nearly the whole of the Arctic, so that if you tried to get through it in a ship, you'd have a lot of difficulty. Today, it's more or less like a blue planet in the Arctic, that the ice lies so far back in the summer that you have an almost ice-free Arctic Ocean. That's a big change. Another big change is that when you're actually on the ice, working in it, you find that there's very little multi-year ice left. That used to be the dominant ice type in the Arctic. Very thick, very rugged, with very big, heavy, thick pressure ridges, maybe 50 metres deep. The ice itself, 3 metres thick. Very hard to get through in a ship. Today, there's almost no multi-year ice left. All the ice forms in 1 year, melts and disappears and has to grow again the next year. So that's called first-year ice. It's only a metre or so thick, and it looks completely different. The actual landscape of the Arctic Ocean has changed completely over the last 30 years.
Do you think this is something we should be concerned about?
I'm sure we should be, and in fact people are concerned about it, because what it's preceding is actual disappearance of the ice, and that's something which could easily happen this year or maybe in the next couple of years. That's disappearance of the ice in the middle of summer, that's in September. That the volume of ice that remains in the summer is now only a quarter of what it was in the 1980s. And if that downward trend continues, there's no reason why it shouldn't do, then the summer volume will go to zero in just a couple of years' time, possibly even this year, which is going to be interesting because I'm going out on an ice breaker this summer. There may not be any ice to break. But that ice-free season, which will start off as being 1 month, will gradually grow until after a few years you'll have about 4 months ice-free. just like we have in the Antarctic at the moment. That's going to be the Arctic of the future, a seasonal ice cover with completely open water during the summer months. And that will have enormous impacts on the various other aspects of global climate.
What is the impact on us as a species of this change?
Well, I mean, the impact on the human species, you have to say, are we talking about Arctic change or global change? I'll talk about Arctic change because that's what I know most about. But the two are linked very strongly because it's the Arctic is warming faster than any other part of the world, and the changes that are happening there are driving changes elsewhere on the planet. But those changes are going to be the ones that will have the bigger effect on mankind. For instance, the disappearance of ice in the Arctic is leading to warmer air masses moving over Greenland in the summer. That's causing the Greenland ice sheet to melt faster, and that's causing global sea level rise to accelerate. So instead of getting maybe less than a metre of sea level rise this century, which is what's predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet could give us a couple of metres or more this century. In fact, some glaciologists are talking about 4 or 5 metres. That might be extreme, but it's very likely to be more sea level rise than has so far been predicted. That means we're being very complacent about sea level rise, and we ought to be realising that many coastal regions, for instance, the coast of Bangladesh, which is very vulnerable, eastern China, and a lot of cities like Miami, will have to be abandoned. And that will have an enormous impact on the global economy and on the lives of people. So that's one thing. That's a minor thing in a way. Then the other thing is that global warming itself is being accelerated by the fact that as the sea ice retreats, that reduces the global average albedo, the amount of radiation that's reflected straight back into space. And that means that the rate of warming will go up. So that, again, this attempt to pretend that we can keep global warming below 2 degrees, which was already a pretense, is even more ridiculous. It's certainly going to get to 4 or 5 degrees by the end of this century, which will then have quite catastrophic impacts on agricultural production, for instance, and being able to support the population that we have now, let alone an increasing population. So that's another impact which people don't think about. And I suppose a third one, which I'm concerned about a lot, in fact, I'm concerned with doing fieldwork in this area at the moment, is whether or not we might have a massive methane outbreak. We're really concerned about the Arctic offshore, that the continental shelves off Siberia are very shallow water. And up until recently, there was always sea ice over those shelves, even in the summer, because the sea ice didn't retreat very much. Now it retreats in the summer and is already disappears for 2, 3, or 4 months off those shelves. That allows the water to warm up, and when the water warms up, it causes the underwater permafrost to melt, which hasn't melted since the last ice age, and that's allowing methane to be released, because there's a lot of methane trapped in methane hydrates under the seabed. And the fear is that this could all happen quite precipitately, that the melting or thawing of the seabed permafrost will allow a lot of methane to be released in a short time, and that would have a very big impact on global warming. The methane is a very powerful global warming gas, and it's impact develops within a very few years, not like carbon dioxide, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, but which stays around for a century. Methane does its thing and then vanishes after about 9 or 10 years. But that thing would consist of perhaps 0.6 of a degree extra warming for the planet just within a few years, which would be catastrophic in relation to the amount of warming we've had already and that we're going to get. It's an extra boost to global warming, which we could do without, but which we're quite likely to be subjected to.
What is the earliest that this could start to be noticed, the effect of this?
The field workers who are studying the emissions of methane from the Arctic shelves are already seeing big increases in the emission rate. We're seeing big plumes of methane coming out of the seabed in the summer, just like an oil blowout, and gas coming up from an oil blowout. But it's big fields of methane gas being released from the seabed, forming big bubble plumes that are being detected. Now, until recently, all that happened was there was one Russian ship went out there every summer, and the people on that have been seeing more methane being emitted each summer, but only in the East Siberian Sea. But we see that there's more shallow seas to the west, the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, and ultimately the Barents Sea. So this last year or two, we've had other cruises by a Swedish icebreaker and a Norwegian icebreaker in the Kara and Laptev Seas, and they're seeing just as much methane coming out there as is coming out in the East Siberian Sea. So the entire coastline of Siberia, the offshore permafrost is disappearing, and all the methane that's in there is likely to be released. And so that we need to know how much methane there is and how fast it'll come out. So that ought to be one of the biggest research projects that man is doing, because it's a massive risk. If you do a risk analysis, the risk of a catastrophe is the probability that it will happen multiplied by what the price would be if it did happen. For instance, you could justify spending a certain amount of money on detecting asteroids, because if an asteroid hit the Earth, the result will be complete catastrophe. But the probability of an asteroid hitting the Earth in any given year is several million to one. You multiply the two, you get a number which some people would say justifies having an asteroid detection system. But with offshore methane, the effect, if it's released on the planet, would be equally catastrophic, or almost as catastrophic, because the amount of warming would be immediate and large. But the probability that it will happen is quite large. I mean, it's I would say it's about 50%, because we're seeing that the permafrost melting, and we're seeing the methane already being released. So it's not a low probability, high catastrophe risk. It's a high catastrophe, high probability risk, which means we should be studying that intensively. So we should be on Earth, we should be making one of our highest scientific priorities studying and trying to do something about the possibility of a methane outbreak from the Arctic. And unfortunately we're not, because that's scarcely mentioned by IPCC in its assessment, because I think it's being criminally complacent in not wanting to stress or even talk about the possibility of some major catastrophes. They were once a body that warned the world about climate change, but now they're a body that's trying to say, well, it's bad, but it's not that bad. Just reduce your carbon emissions and everything will be okay. But it won't, because these things are something that have come along. There's enormous evidence that this is happening, and we should be really worried about it. We should be spending our money on these things, because they could be a very rapid catastrophe for the planet.
Do you have any idea of a way of stopping this?
The only way, as far as offshore methane is concerned, for instance, would be bring back Arctic sea ice. And some people are saying, let's try and do that. But the trouble is, you can't really bring back Arctic sea ice without cooling the planet. Nobody's thought of a targeted method that will simply cause sea ice to grow or not retreat around the edges of the Arctic Ocean. The sea ice growth and decay is governed by global temperatures. So finding a way to bring back sea ice won't work unless you can cool the entire planet. But the only way that I can think of, or that anybody has thought of, is this method that, curiously, the oil industry has come up with, which is a modification of the fracking method to have offshore wells, offshore platforms along the Arctic coastline, off just in shallow water, and then drill down and have a network of horizontal drilling into cavities, or creation of cavities, to try to suck in the methane and then pump it out through the well without it actually breaking through the seabed and rising to the atmosphere. So there's no research being done on that. It's just been suggested. But somebody should be doing research on this before it happens. Otherwise, we've really had it.
Is methane, when it dissipates, is it not just equivalent to, say, 27? It's apparently 27 times worse than carbon dioxide. In other words, a 27 times stronger carbon dioxide amount.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. It is about 27 times as powerful. So every molecule of methane causes 23, I think, times as much warming as one molecule of carbon dioxide. But after about 7 years in the atmosphere, a molecule of methane is likely to be oxidized in the atmosphere, and it turns into a molecule of carbon dioxide.
One molecule, or 27?
It's just one. So it loses its power, really, because its warming power is reduced to 1/27 of what it used to be. So it's when the methane is in the form of methane that it's most dangerous. And when it gets oxidized to carbon dioxide, it's much less dangerous. It's less than 1/20 as dangerous.
Do you think our children have a future?
Only if we take action now. And my fear is that the current generation of world leaders, politicians, I won't call them statesmen because they're not, is too cowardly to take any action now, because any action would involve such a large disruption of our present way of life that they don't want to take it because they might not get re-elected. So there's a conspiracy of complacency throughout the world in which they still imagine that if we do a few minor things and a few minor adjustments and reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, then all will be well. But it won't, because we've already got too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We're already going to have more than 2 degrees warming, even if we don't emit any more, because of the already existing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So we've got to not only stop emitting it or reduce emissions, but find ways to take it out of the atmosphere. And that's a technology that hasn't been developed, would be a massive research program to develop, but we should be doing it. It's a bit like the Manhattan Project. We should be doing it from the point of view of our own survival. And that's the sort of thing that the present generation should be concentrating all our attention on. And if we can do that, then our children have got a future. If we don't, what I can see happening is that we'll see, because climate change has a progressive effect, so that it doesn't hit you today or tomorrow. There's not a sudden, it's not like some virus. It works its way slowly through the world. So you can ascribe some particular hurricane to random factors. But when you put together all the changes that are going on, you see how they're ramping up to become a major change. And as they go on, they tend to accelerate. Everything's increasing exponentially. So my fear is that nobody will do anything because of cowardice and inertia and all the normal human attributes. They'll sort of say, well, let's wait until it really hits us and then we'll act. But by the time it really hits us, by the time weather changes have made it impossible to feed everybody in the world, for instance, and we have worldwide famine, by the time those sort of changes of that scale have happened, it's too late to do anything. We will by then have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to prevent a kind of runaway global climate catastrophe. So my fear is that it's our own inertia will lead us to not take action until it's actually too late to save ourselves. The forces of inertia are so enormous. Use of fossil fuels, for instance, is so built into our society that with the best will in the world, it's really hard to get out of the mindset of using them. And that applies to sort of everything. We've built a society in the last 150 years in which kind of everybody has several hundred slaves at their disposal, which is basically the extra help you get from engines and motors and everything that is produced by burning fossil fuels. And we can't live without that, but we have to try and find ways to do it with other sources of energy. But it's hard and difficult, and nobody wants to do it. So the world will likely notice that things are changing, but will still be reluctant to actually take any steps until the changes are so great that they really do immediately threaten our existence, by which time it is too late.
If you were to be elected King Peter of the whole world today, and you could say, don't worry, I think there's something we could do, and they had to do what you told them to do, what would you say right now?
Well, I would say stop spending all of the world's scientific money on military research, which at the moment about 90% of research funds in the world are spent on military research. Take all the scientists in the world and all the funds that are presently spent on military research and switch into studying, first of all, how do we take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, because that's the only way ultimately that will save us, is to bring the CO2 level down. And we can only do that by some drastic method of actually removing CO2 from the atmosphere. We can't do it by messing around with reducing our emissions. We can't even do it by stopping our emissions, because things have gone too far. We've got to actually take it out the atmosphere. So I would order the world scientists to make that the biggest research program in the world, and forget military research, forget NASA and so on. Do that. And along with that, do the things that can protect us in the shorter term against specific nasty things which are coming along but are generally disregarded, like a methane outbreak or a weather changes which will cut back on food production. We find ways of trying to evolve our methods of food production or the species that we grow so that we can adapt to the impact that's bound to happen. Make climate change research the main thrust of the entire world scientific effort, and do it urgently.
Would you consider it also a good idea to suspend our economies until we've changed our fuel source?
Well, we can't really. That's the thing. We want to be able to feed everybody on the planet, and much of agriculture is industrial. We've got 8 or 9 billion people because we've industrialised agriculture, and that requires at the moment fossil fuels. So we can't suddenly switch off. We've got to. The only way we can. Then that's why I'm saying we have to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, because all the ways that people have proposed to gradually modify the way we live such that we live more sustainably, they will all take time to happen, and they're taking so much time that they haven't even started. The threat from carbon dioxide is immediate; it's there now, so we have to deal with that, which means a science and technology hitting it. I mean, people have said, well, this is terrible, this ideas of geoengineering or carbon dioxide removal, because it's giving us an excuse not to do anything about reducing our carbon emissions and lead leading more sustainable lives. And there's some truth in that, but the trouble is the time scales are wrong. We should be leading more sustainable lives, living in a better way, in harmony with the planet, etc. But it will take decades to do that, and we haven't got decades. We have to use a technology-based approach to get rid of some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere just to save ourselves from a complete catastrophe.
If we took drastic action before the end of this year, what do you estimate our chances of reversing this situation?
Well, if it's really drastic, then I think we can. We won't be able to avoid 2 degrees of warming, but we can maybe stop it if we can develop CO2 removal. We can stop it before it gets to, say, 3 or 4. So we can gradually bring things under control and or at least reduce the rate of warming to the point where it is possible to adapt to it. At the moment, it's accelerating to the point where we can't adapt. But I think if we take really serious action, and it has to be really serious now, that we can survive.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams from Cambridge, UK. Judy Saul is founder of the University of Earth in South Africa. She spoke to him on May 15 of 2015. My thanks to Professor Wadhams for his permission to edit the interview for radio and to Judy Saul for her initiative, questions, and production. You can find her successful YouTube film under the title Our Time is Running Out, The Arctic Sea Ice is Going. I'm also creating a link to the film on tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Now we're very pleased to say that Ted Schmidt is in the building, and Ted Schmidt has a terrific site, theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com, and of course, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Phil.
And,
nice to be here.
I got to remind everybody, you were in with us not so long ago to talk about the book by Claude Lacaille, but also you've been discussing how significant this to change. I can certainly... I'm not a Catholic, but I can feel it, of this new pope. Yeah. And now he's just made a remarkable visit. He went to Havana, then he went to Washington, and he finished off in Philadelphia. Give us an assessment. What kind of message has he been giving, and how are you responding?
I think it's quite extraordinary when you watch all of the networks all the time, pope all the time. Everywhere, CNN, Canadian television, all over radio, et cetera, et cetera. And one wonders why. You know, we live in a pretty much of a secular culture, and this man is the head of a church that's been the butt of jokes because of the pedophile crisis. Why would they be looking to this man? Is it mere celebrity culture? Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of it. But I think people around the world, given the gap between the rich and the poor, people are really looking for a moral voice. And this man's life really incarnates the values of Jesus. His commitment to the poor, his very, very abstemious lifestyle, extremely impressive man. Hmm. So he's walking the walk. And people say, well, we can listen to this man because he's not remote like Cardinal Ratzinger was. He was a good man, but he really never had a common touch. I'm just astonished that there's just so much coverage of this. I think what he's been able to do, particularly in the States, is change the public discourse. Mm-hmm. I call it a turbo capitalist culture.
Turbo.
It's extraordinarily run by the predatory capitalists and economic fundamentalism.
By the way, he uses these kind of words,
yeah,
capitalist, and that's verboten in our culture.
Well, that's.
I was even going to ask. It was going to be one of my joke questions. Is yeah. He's not a capitalist? How can he be a pope?
Well, that's a good point. So he changes the conversation. There's no doubt about it, and people are astonished. He has this nerve to go into the heart of capitalism and. Speak.
And mention that he doesn't is not enamored of capitalism.
That the market isn't the be-all and the end-all. Mm-hmm. And all the libertarians and all the friends of Alan Greenspan, who saw the destruction of so much of the U.S. economy with so much greed, they go crazy. But John Paul II said this, the market, it could be valuable if it's not dominated by massive capital. But it never answers two things, the dignity of the human person and the environment. And as you know, this unprecedented encyclical, Laudato Si, on the environment has captured the world's yes. attention. Mm-hmm. So it's quite extraordinary that one man could come and change the conversation and talk about receiving immigrants, talk about the gap between the rich and the poor, talk about the environment. So at that level, it was quite extraordinary. And remember when he talked in the U.S. Congress there, he mentioned four people. And I guarantee you, most of the people—
One of Phil's favorites is going to come up.
Most
here.
Of the people never heard of two of them. He mentioned Lincoln, and to talk about the freedom of the slaves.
Yes.
My particular hero, Dr. King, who was able to put the gospel onto the street and not leave it in a church. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Dr. King is well known. But he also mentioned Dorothy Day,
uh-huh.
The great defender of the radically poor and pacifist in New York City, who was basically scorned or merely tolerated in her life. But now was up for canonization. But most Americans would never have probably heard about her. But also Thomas Merton. Merton, electrocuted in 1968, was this phenomenal monk who prized the contemplative life but also was a radical anti-war man and had a great impact in the Second Vatican Council. So you can imagine people going to the internet trying to find
yes.
out who the hell is this guy talking about. So he's his own man. People I know who work in Rome say he really doesn't care, about popular acceptance or about offending these massive capitalists that have dominated the world stage for so long. So at that level, I was very moved by this. And of course—
Well, Raul Castro was quite moved. He said, I think I might return to the church.
Well,
he said, I could see myself going to church.
Who said that?
Raul.
Oh, yeah, Raul Castro. That's right.
And, by the way, there's a wonderful photograph of Fidel with him.
Yeah.
Shaking hands.
Well, he's very inclusive, this pope. You have to hand it to him. And you see, when he went to Congress, he said, Mr. John Boehner, no thanks. I don't want to have lunch with you. I'm going out to have lunch with the poor. Yeah. I mean, this is just unbelievable. Boehner and so many of these right-wing Catholics say, I don't take my economics from this pope, etc. Yeah. So
that came as a shock to
me. Yeah. But, the big thing, of course, in our world today is Syria and the massive immigration, and Germany taking over 800,000 people. Now, here's a pope that comes, and what he's saying is a fundamental gospel truth. There is only one human family. There's not countries. These are just arbitrary laws. I mean, we owe the dignity of every human being. And he said, you're called to defend and preserve the dignity of your fellow citizens. And pony up, take more. This just isn't a European problem. You can't ask all of these poor countries like Greece and Romania, you know, to the Germans, for many reasons, have stepped up and done this. So he privileges the common good, which is a central part of Catholic social teaching, not individualism, which was unheard of up until the Enlightenment. You know, it was all the people, the common good. And so this is maybe, well, some people are calling him a communist. Yeah. Well, I mean, he is, you know, a Christian communist. I mean, that's
the moment he differs with Washington or London about priorities, if he differs, and it's noted, and he is obviously a communist. This, you know, that's how they divide the world.
Well,
or he's an Islamic extremist.
Yes. Well, people see through that, you know, but people also see that the market ideology has radically failed around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have 1 billion people living on a loonie a day, this is Oxfam, you have 2 more billion living on a toonie. You have 73 individuals in the United States who have as much wealth as one half of humanity. Mm. The trickle-down theory hasn't worked. Yes. You know, and it's getting worse. And all of these capitalists say, well, look, it's raised all boats. Well, it's raised the yachts.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And now in America, they have more private policemen defending these people behind massive guarded houses. And so is there going to be a revolution? Chris Hedges, among others, is talking about this. I mean, how long can this go?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the work has gone, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I did an interview with the CBC when this environmental thing came out. And they said, well, what would you do? And I said, well, if I was the cardinal, it would be very simple. There's 220 parishes in Toronto. I would immediately call them in for a meeting. And I would say the following. You all have advanced copies of this incredible encyclical, unprecedented, that deals with the central moral issue of our time. He puts abortion to the side. He puts pelvic orthodoxy that the last two popes have been obsessed with, you know, homosexuality.
It's the only thing on their mind.
It's the only thing on their mind. And he says the gap between the rich and the poor, and we are burning the planet down. And he uses strong language, and it's so well written.
By the way, I was going to say,
yeah,
one of the reasons we're not to turn to the Pope's comments and the documents you referred to, those are all intellectually sound, deep, well-researched. This is not shallow work.
No.
These are not sound bites.
No, and he calls people like Naomi Klein. And
he's met with Naomi Klein.
Oh, of course. So getting back to what
should
I would
make
do.
Her a cardinal.
It seems common sense to me. You know, 220 parishes, only one of them is doing anything. And he would – here I'm being the cardinal now, say, got 220 pastors there.
Cardinal Schmidt.
Yeah, thank you. You've got now 6 weeks to arrange a series of talks, dialogues in your parish. And you got all sorts of lay people that will facilitate this. There's so much talent out there in the Catholic community. Okay, the next thing that you're going to do, you are all going to take out a membership in one of three groups, the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, or the Suzuki, and get involved. Because if the meeting that you are having in your parish is not connected to a movement outside of your parish, you are wasting your time.
Mm-hmm.
And most Catholic parishes are very good at Christmas baskets.
Yeah, it's not as though there's no precedent. Edicts are given, right? They say, we want you to work on this, and they do have meetings. So why not on this issue?
And people are fantastic. There's generosity, but it stops at the level of charity, not at the level of justice. We need people to get into the world and go to these movements. The movements are ones that change governments, like Greenpeace has, like Friends of the Earth, etc. So when I went on this the CBC show, they played my clip to the Cardinal. I said, well, here's what Ted Schmidt says. And, well, kind of a put down. It's nice that he's read it, you know. Come on. Okay. But then he does the Jackie Gleason. Remember Jackie Gleason used to go, hamana, hamana, hamana?
Yeah, yes.
Because what I said was true. Yeah. None of these parishes are engaged. And they haven't been. Why? Because the most talented group of priests have left the church. In my lifetime, working for justice, they've all gone. They got married, and who did they replace them with? I mean, we are really suffering in parishes because we're coming. You know, we have some nice people coming from Poland and Sri Lanka and India, but they don't. They bring a misogyny. They don't bring an analysis of the world. They don't bring an understanding of Canadian life or Canadian mm-hmm. social teaching. So, in my work with students, they all would say to me, what you in the religion department was about, Vatican II, you get inserted into the world. You become an agent of the kingdom of God, an agent of justice. That made sense to us. Then we went out. I meet with my former students a lot, and they say, we went into parishes, nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. And then they drift off from the church. So this is shocking that in the last, from this is the Pew Research, between 2000 and 2010, 30 million Catholics have left the church.
Whoa.
This is staggering, and a lot of it, of course,
but,
had to
doesn't
do—
doesn't that account for the rise of Francis in the sense that a real crisis? The leaders must have been talking
what's
going to happen
right.
here.
That,
how much worse can this
get? The present pope was a runner-up to the last pope. And, you know, these are good men, these cardinals that voted, and they said, it's obvious we have to do a U-turn mm-hmm. because there's massive defections. So I was reading my hero, Dr. King— and remember the famous—
he's a Baptist Catholic.
1963. Remember, he's in jail in Birmingham. And he says, my heart is broken over the failure of the church to witness. He says, the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. And that's what it's become.
And this is what Francis is saying.
This is what Francis is trying to bring us back. And when he goes back to Rome, they're going to have this whole colloquium on the family. But it's different in that he has solicited the wisdom of the lay people. This is the big thing that came in my lifetime since Vatican II, the idea of the sensus fidelium. Unless you are talking to the people who are so much more intelligent now than they ever were 50 years ago, you had to get a letter from a parish priest or somebody to study theology. So we lived in a very clerical church. 50 years later, lay people are smarter than the people they're bringing in as priests. There is so much talent there that has not been used, but it's very hard. It's an old institution, as you know. And
261 popes?
And it moves slowly. People like myself, we're living in a computer age. We have to move faster. And this is what Francis is doing. He's got one lung. He says, I'm not going to live long. So he's naming third world cardinals, you know, with a different vision of what the world is. Because the leadership that we have had under the last two popes has been really bad. And this is what the theologians were saying. They've put in one-dimensional men, gray men, who have been obsessed with whatever Rome said, never listening to the people, not having parish councils where there would be so much talent to change the dialogue. So Francis is doing that, and it's quite extraordinary. What is the effect that he's going to have? This is very interesting. I'm not optimistic. I think that the leadership at the parish level is abysmal. And what's going to happen? More and more Christians are going to get involved. Will they come back to the church? They will. This guy maybe has inspired people to give the church another shot. But if they're going to hear the same old stuff, mm-hmm. and this time with an accent that you don't understand— you know, from Nigeria or Poland, and I don't mind that. I'm a believer in the universal church, but I want people to come that have accepted the wisdom of Vatican II, that we're supposed to be engaged in the world. We're supposed to transform society, not sit back and just worry about the Catholic Church. No, We are inserted with all the Christian churches, with the synagogues, the mosques, in a transformative mode.
Mm-hmm.
So look at the witness. Eh? He's in the Fiat, the little car. Yes. You know, he washes the feet. He goes out and he's
He went to a prison, a U.S.
He goes
prison.
To prisons. And as I said,
he probably noticed there were a number of black prisoners there.
And he probably did. And said, and what a good place to go in the most incarcerated nation in the world
yes.
is to go into a prison. Hey, the Americans are famous for locking everybody up, throwing away the key.
Yes.
And this is what this Pope is saying. Go to the margins. Go to the fringe of society. Goes to those people with no voices. In the Bible, in the New Testament, was the widow, the orphan. Mm-hmm. But find out the prisoners, you know, where is the need? And, you know, he's trying to show an example. Like, I've been at this for a long time, and I have never seen bishops in front of the American embassy when they were bombing the hell out of Nicaragua and El Salvador. I've never seen them involved in any of these issues. There hasn't been much of a witness there, you know, from the institutional church. Inside, many good priests, you know, that have been privately working and you will see them active, but not much leadership from the top.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, for us, I mean, of course, you just raised the Vatican II, with John the 23rd, wasn't it? And,
yes.
And then we had a wonderful phenomenon called liberation theology.
We did.
And it really, many people were taken by that and admired it, and particularly in South America. And then it was just like a blizzard came and almost killed all the crops. But here you have back. Does he comment on that historical period? Where was he? What was his take on liberation theology? Do you know his story?
Yes, I do. And, you know, he missed
By the way,
boat.
This is Ted Schmidt. I want to make sure you know the site, theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, he was aware. He said he wasn't ready to assume leadership with the Jesuits.
He was in a dangerous place called Argentina.
He was. And he wasn't guilty. I mean, I knew that. He wasn't on the side of the generals. I went to Perez Esquivel, who I interviewed many years ago, Nobel Prize winner, and said, no, he doesn't have blood on his hands. So he was a great man.
A lot of them did, I guess.
Yeah. But look at Phil. We only had 14 years of Vatican II before John Paul came in and shut the door and turned it back into an authoritarian clerical church. Mm-hmm. 14 years. But that spirit was so powerful that you couldn't shut it down. I mean, when I was 21, Germany was 21, said Goethe. You know, when I was 21, the Vatican II hit. And it so inspired me as a young Catholic to move into the world. And it did so many. And all of those priests that I knew, you know, they were phenomenal. But many of them told me by 1970, the door was starting to close again, and the priests took over.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy's trying to change it. He still has problems with the woman question. There's no doubt about it. But a pope cannot be seen to contradict the previous pope right away. He's got to wait. That's going to be in another pontificate. But it is a sore problem for Catholics, is that we have not accepted the total equality of women at every level of the church, including being pope.
Yeah.
And let's start. Many years ago, I interviewed the great Bishop Alex Carter, and he had tears in his eyes as he was retiring. He told me in a private meeting, I said, Alex, you called for the ordination of married men in 1971, and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, we're stuck. We're just stuck, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, First Nations, start ordaining men up in the Northwest Territories. You know, the Anglicans have ordained in the last 40 years 50 men. The Catholics, none, because of Rome. And those wonderful bishops, those oblates, have gone to Rome and said, please allow us to ordain married men in the First Nations community. They do not accept celibacy. Rome shut the door.
Yeah.
So maybe this man will be a little open. He's an incredible learner. But I wouldn't get too enthused about the woman question, you know. It is a soreness.
He doesn't treat it in that cold-blooded and nasty way that
no.
is – it's obvious. This is he gives you a human reaction. There's that sort of severe cold look that came across the face of his predecessors when these matters were talked about. You could tell that the whip was somewhere in the room, you know.
Well, yeah, you'd be on the margin somewhere. You'd be sent off to the farthest parish. And I've known priests that has happened to.
Now, this is Ted Schmidt, and I mentioned theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com.
Never neutral,
A Teaching Life, a terrific book. Your recent articles at that site, and I was looking at them, it's great material. I really urge people to go to the site. You use the expression the prophetic.
Yeah.
Oh, and I want to talk about two things at once. And there's also, you say the church got into trouble because of the Constantine
Arrangement.
Arrangement.
Right.
So could you elaborate on those two
matters?
Sure.
You know, the early disciples of Jesus were in trouble like he was. You know, crucifixions, living in margins, Roman oppression. They were alive. They were pacifist. But by the time of Constantine, Constantine took over and the church made an arrangement and jumped into bed with the highest authority. And we've never really got out. Rather than being a ginger group in society that would renovate society with other people, we always like to be on the side of power.
King Constantine.
Yeah. And Mark Ellis uses the expression about Constantinian Judaism. Judaism, an incredible world religion in Israel, has become part of the Constantinian Judaism.
Headache. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So the prophetic, of course, is the great gift that the prophets of Israel gave the world, to stand up to the king, to tell the king that he is naked when he's naked, to pull the curtain like the Wizard of Oz did against the wizard and say, "You're naked." And we have always had prophets, and we mentioned Merton and Martin Luther King. These are people who came out of
Dorothy Day. I love the fact that you brought her up. That's great.
You know, they come out of the bowels of the church, you know, and they're often on the margins and on the edge. But the prophet and the prophetic is always alive. It pops up, and this pope is part of the prophetic. It's just an extraordinary time in our Catholic history.
He doesn't take calls from Washington the way those other guys
do. No, he doesn't. And he phones people on the margins. Oh, yeah, he picks the phone up and he talks to people that he knew in Argentina, and they don't believe it's the Pope.
You know, it's rather like we just had this phenomenon with Jeremy Corbyn, who wanted to ask questions based on – he asked ordinary Brits – to give him questions for the prime minister, and the prime minister thought it was funny that we had to listen to ordinary. But it's rather interesting coincidence of personalities that Corbyn should rise to be the leader of the Labour Party at a time when it's up. He probably owes the Pope a little bit, because the Pope is giving a boost to such people.
He does. Have you read this anywhere? The three Catholic Supreme Court justices boycotted the Pope.
Really?
Yeah. They were not in the audience. They're extremely conservative Catholics, and this is really a slap in the face to the direction that Francis is taking.
They are not on the road to sainthood, I can tell them that. Ted Schmidt, it's really a pleasure seeing you. By the way, that website, theologyinthevineyard.wordpress.com, you'll find the healthiest Catholic writing on the the globe. Anyway, Ted, thank you very, very much.
A great pleasure to be here again. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.